August 20th, 2019 meeting of the Carson City Parks and Recreation Commission. Madam Secretary, will you call order, please?
Chair Kiefer.
Here.
Vice Chair Cartwright.
Here.
Commissioner Bagwell.
Here.
Commissioner Cassiopeia.
Commissioner Long.
Here.
Commissioner Meyer.
Here.
Commissioner Whitefield.
Here.
A quorum is present.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. Now comes the point in the agenda where we'll open up for public comments for items that are not on the agenda. Does anybody have any public comments? Come on down, CK.
How's that? We're good? Testing. Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, Commissioners. Appreciate it. I am, for the record, Kevin C.K. Bailey, Carson City. I wish to thank this evening and recognize Mr. Eric Klug for his constant search for relevant educational programs for kids, his aggressive helpfulness, and his enduring kindness. Just a couple of examples are Eric's efforts in approaching the Nevada Department of Wildlife's bringing in trout in the classroom into the kindergarten room here. It was fantastic this year. So the kindergarten age kids got to see that. And he helped put together with the Nevada Department of Wildlife a group that was able to teach kids that were in the day camp, if you will, in this area, in this same building, kids' introduction to casting and fishing, and kids, and they even got to tie a trout fly, and they came away with it. So it was a really cool thing for the kids. So I thank Eric Klug again, and that's about it, Madam Chair, Commissioners. Thank you so kindly.
Thank you for those kind words. I'm just sorry Eric wasn't here to hear them.
He was just in and out. He's a busy guy.
I know he is, but thank you for your kind words and for recognizing him. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Any other comments? All right, then let's move on to our possible action on the approval of our minutes from our June 17th. 2019 meeting.
I have just a quick change on page 7 under item 5. I requested meeting information about smoking and vaping in parks, and it just doesn't, that part's not referenced in there. It looks like it's related to the graduation. That was my only change.
Okay. Any other comments or changes from the commission members? All right. All right. In that case, I'll enter.
Motion. I move to approve the minutes of June 17, 2019 as corrected.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
All right.
Can I make just one comment? This is just for the Parks and Rec side of things, not the open space. Just want to make sure that's consistent. It's true.
It's a joint meeting, so we have to approve.
Okay.
We'll both be
approved. So we're just approving our side of it. We're not approving the open space. I just want to make that clear.
Thank you. Appreciate that. All right. So we have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
The motion carries. All right. Modifications to the agenda. Jennifer, do you have a modification?
No modifications.
Do any of the commissioners have any modifications they'd like to see? All right, so we're good to go. All right, let's go on to meeting 3A for discussion only. The Park Program of the Month, a presentation regarding the Junior Giants Baseball Program by Scott Chapman. Scott, can you get away, please?
Scott Chapman for the record. Tonight we just wanted to talk about our program of the month. It's our youth baseball program called the Junior Giants. Tonight with me is Jade Hickman and Tanner Mertz from the Boys and Girls Club. As we go through the PowerPoint tonight, feel free to ask any questions at any point, but there's also an opportunity to ask any questions. The Junior Giants program is brought to you by the San Francisco Community Fund, Carson City Parks and Recreation, and the Boys and Girls Club of Western Nevada. The Junior Giants program is a youth co-ed baseball program for ages 5 to 13. It just ended its 25th season. It is a program that's free to the public. One thing I kind of want to note about with it being free to the public, that includes all the equipment, baseballs, baseball bats, gloves, helmets, safety equipment, t-shirts, hats, the whole nine yards. This program hosts over 24,000 children, over 92 leagues throughout Oregon, California, and Northern Nevada. The three leagues in Northern Nevada is Reno, South Lake Tahoe, and Carson City. It's a non-competitive baseball program that also emphasizes character development. Those include health, education, bullying, prevention, and also teaching the fundamentals of baseball. The Junior Giants program is funded by the San Francisco Giants Community Fund, so it's a separate funding from the actual Giants, and so that's how all the baseballs, the bats, et cetera, are given to us. A little bit more specifically with Carson City, the Junior Giants programs ran in a three-way partnership, like I said a couple minutes ago, with Carson City Parks and Recreation, Boys and Girls Club, and the Giants Community Fund. We started our first season in 2016, so 4 years ago. We had just over 150 enrolled children with 30 adult volunteer coaches, assistant coaches, and team parents. We just finished our fourth season with over 210 enrolled children and 70-plus adult volunteers. Historically, the Carson City Junior Giants program runs Monday and Fridays at Pete Livermore Sports Complex. We usually start the first week of June and end the first week of August. One more here. I do want to talk about the people that make this program possible. It's staffed by one part-time Parks and Recreation employee, a Boys and Girls Club staff member, and then Jade Hickman. Even though we staff it, the program itself is solely pretty much ran off volunteers. Without the volunteers, you know, we wouldn't have this program. It also, I think it promotes a family atmosphere within the program, which is fantastic. Like I say, we had over 70 adult volunteers. These included older siblings, parents, grandparents. All volunteers that are a part of the program go through a thorough background check that is paid for and completed by the San Francisco Giants Community Fund. That's kind of a brief description of the program itself. The kind of one of the big reasons we're here is Jade. I've mentioned her a couple times now. She's a rock star. She, between the rec division and the Boys and Girls Club, we offer as much support to Jade as she possibly would need. But she's definitely the backbone of the program. I wanted to take just a second to kind of explain some of her duties and, you know, why we're going to be discussing them. She is employed by the Junior Giants, and she works in a partnership with us in the Boys and Girls Club. She's been our ambassador since the first year of the program. Which is pretty unheard of. A lot of these ambassadors, they're around for a year or two. They're typically college-age students. Once they kind of finish up school, they tend to move on. But we've been lucky enough to have her 4 years, and I think she's verbally committed to one more year for us, which I'm very excited about. She works approximately 20 to 30 hours a week with the Junior Giants program with us. Those include, you know, 10 hours a week at the actual program itself. Some of her typical tasks would include scheduling weekly communications with parents and volunteers, preparing the equipment, submitting background checks, ensuring weekly character building lessons are being taught by the coaches, preparing weekly handouts, attending parent meeting and coach volunteer meetings, organizing health fairs, collecting surveys, as well as many other tasks that are just too much to list. In addition to being the backbone of the Junior Giants program for us, she's also a full-time college student and a part-time employee at the University of Nevada, Reno in the Multicultural Diversity Center. with everything she's been able to do for us over the last few years, I think myself and the Boys and Girls Club, we decided to nominate her for it. It was called the Ambassador All-Star Award, and luckily she was selected for it this year. She was only one of four ambassadors selected for this award out of 92 leagues. And we're very excited for her. October 10th, she was given the award in front of 35,000 plus participants, or not participants, but spectators at a baseball game in San Francisco. And so, you know, we wanted to tell you guys about the program first of all, but also kind of recognize Jade for everything that she's done for us in our program. So thank you, Jade. And that's kind of the gist of the program and, you know, everything Jade does for us. Do you guys have any questions before we kind of move on?
Awesome. You guys rock. Thanks, Jade, and thanks for that presentation. I was just wondering if, and it doesn't have to be now, if I could get a copy of the curriculum that the kids learn for, like, the bullying prevention, the personal development, the, like, life skills that they learn in this program. I'd just be interested to see what that is. And thanks again.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll get you a copy of it.
So, Jade, why don't you tell us what actually motivates you?
I love this job, and being able to make a positive impact on the community has been really just fun, and getting to work for the Giants is definitely an added bonus to that.
For five more years? I think I heard a year, but
for sure a year, and then I'll graduate, but doesn't mean I'm not going to keep working. So
thank you for all you've done. Thank you.
We're still in contract negotiations right now.
You're going to give her a signing bonus? Yeah. She's going to get a signing bonus?
Yeah. More work.
More work, yeah. All right. Any other questions or comments from the commissioners? All right. Thank you so much, Scott. Jade, we really appreciate everything you put into this program.
Thank you, guys.
All right, next on the agenda, for discussion only, a presentation by Duncan Golf Course Management regarding operations and management of the Eagle Valley Golf Course. This is Scott and Jennifer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jennifer Budge, Parks and Recreation Director. Hold this up. I'm here today with Scott from Duncan Golf. As you know, the city owns Eagle Valley Golf Course. It's a beautiful course on the north end of the city. Previously, a nonprofit organization operated it for 20 years. When the agreement for that nonprofit had expired, we did a request for proposal competitive process, and Duncan Golf was the most responsive and responsible bidder on that project. So now that we've had a year under our belt, I asked Scott to come here and give an update on all that they've accomplished over the year. From an operator's perspective, they've been great to work with. They respond to any complaints or concerns immediately, and the course conditions are so much better than the way we provided it to them when they started. So I appreciate all that they've done, and look forward to, you know, sharing with you all that they've accomplished in this last year.
All right, Scott Wachowski, Duncan Golf Management. Like Jennifer said, I'm here just to review 2018, talk briefly kind of where we are in 2019, and how excited we are for 2020. So we'll go ahead and get started here. Where it all began, we submitted for the request proposal, was successful enough to get an interview, and then win the bid. I think we met in this room December 10th, and we got started December 11th. We realized that the golf course was at a pivotal turning point in its future, and we felt pretty passionate about getting in there and securing the assets. So when we first got in there, the golf course really needed a little bit of TLC. Although it was December 11th, we were on a very warm fall and somewhat of a drought tea year. So we got in there, and we were doing things that we typically wouldn't do on a golf course till early to late March, sometimes April. We turned on the irrigation system, which was not characteristic of December, but it was warm, and the golf course hadn't really been irrigated since October. So at that dry November, December, we felt it was necessary. During that short period of time, we also got in there and started doing some agronomic practices to the golf course that would typically would not happen until the end of February, early March. And anyway, we had to jump all over the golf course. We also found very quickly that the golf carts that were there were not adequate for 18 holes of golf. Part of the reason that the revenues were suffering so poorly with the previous management. So we moved 30 golf carts from Dayton Valley Golf Course that we run right out there in Dayton to facilitate golf for the month of December. December typically is not a very busy golf month, but it was once we got there because the weather was so nice. So got in there, got the water going, found some things there, got some golf carts, and then by April 1st, we finalized an agreement with Carson City, and then we hit the ground running. And it was kind of nice to have that little bit of a bridge agreement because we got in there and kind of figured some things out before we really got going. So it was good. So our goals for the first year, one was to establish rate integrity. We talked a lot about that in our request for proposal. And one of our cornerstones of our company, we charge what we say we charge. There's no dealing at the counter. Improved golf course condition was going to be something that was going to sustain business for that golf course for the future. Secure maintenance equipment, which was a real big point of the entire agreement with Carson City. Along with that was securing a new golf cart fleet. And then overall, with all that said, improving the overall golf experience so that we could grow the business back in sustainable revenues. And then ultimately with all that, then you got to figure out how you get the word out there to the public so they'll come and enjoy the facility. Establishing rate integrity. One thing that we have found at other golf courses that we've taken over in Eagle Valley was kind of in that same boat is that what was published and what the rates were out there to the public wasn't really what was being charged at the counter. And for a sustainable business, that can be very counterproductive, and you can't pay your bills if you're always discounting at the counter. So we stuck firm in that, and what we found was not that the rounds of golf were growing, but the revenues were growing significantly. And almost each and every month throughout 2018, we had exceeded the previous year's revenue numbers. Now, I don't think that's just because of the rate. There were a lot of other things that were going there, but we had improved and exceeded past revenues each and every month. During that time, there were numerous events that were contracted for the previous year, and we honored each and every one of them at the price that they were originally contracted. So they did affect our average green fee quite a bit because they were contracted much lower. And then the overall operational year in our rate integrity with our customer, our casino partners, by having that rate integrity, they could trust that they were getting a fair price for a fair product. Improved golf course conditions, like I said earlier, we were doing things very early on that we typically wouldn't do too much later in the spring, partially because it's kind of outside the textbook, but we felt like we had to really jump on this just to save some things out there. The greens were very dry, spotty with turf coverage, so we jumped on things, and we were doing agronomic practice one, which is called verticutting, which is a pretty aggressive practice to do when your irrigation system is not fully operational. Well, we took that risk, got the irrigation system going, and found massive improvements there. When we started turning on the irrigation system, we ran into almost overwhelming issues with the irrigation system and the amount of heads that were not operating, which was one of the main reasons for the decline. They had just stopped repairing irrigation. So shortly after we got the deal finalized, we purchased about 50 irrigation heads, which is about $10,000, which blew our irrigation budget out, certainly for the month of April, and that's typically what we'll spend on irrigation heads for 2 to 3 seasons. But it was necessary. That was the only way we were going to get the turf grass to come back in there. We started a sound fertility program, and then we purchased this funny little machine up there that everyone gets a kick out of when we operate it, but it's the new age of aeration. We don't pull cores, disrupt revenue. This machine creates 100% aeration to the soil, and we use it at all of our properties. We've used it for the past 3 years, and it's just absolutely phenomenal. So Eagle Valley owns one of those. One of the big points of this contract with Duncan Golf Management and the city was that our lease payment is essentially the purchase of new equipment for the facility. When we went in there and were discussing, hey, do we want to do this deal? Do we not want to do this deal? We found that the maintenance equipment for sustainability of the property was in just dire need. So we spent and continue to spend in excess of $90,000 a year in lease payments to secure about $400,000 worth of turf maintenance equipment. Shortly after the contract, which was a little unfortunate that we got the deal finalized in April, that's one of the busiest times that golf carts are being ordered throughout the country. So we got put a little on the back burner, didn't get carts in, and I think fully stocked till about the middle of July. We got some shipments in late May, another shipment in June, and then we didn't get fully up till July. But the golf carts were unbelievable for the customers. They are, one, the latest and greatest golf cart. They have USB ports in them, and then they just drive like Cadillacs. So they were fantastic, especially from what the past customer had experienced without getting 18 holes of golf. This is a very comfortable golf cart, and we were super excited to get 120 of those out there buzzing around the golf course. The overall golf experience, a big thing that we knew we had to correct, and with having the rate integrity, the golf course condition improving, and then the golf cart where you could actually make it around 18 holes and not worry about getting stuck all the way out in the West course, we found that the online reviews were going through the roof. People were saying, hey, the best they've ever seen it, never had such a good experience. We were very fortunate to inherit some of the staff there, but not a lot. Some people left, some people weren't there anymore, but we were able to create a culture within the clubhouse that extended out to the golf course and felt like we really had improved the overall golf experience. Okay, the tricky part, how do we get the word out? So we felt like, hey, these were our goals for the year. We were hitting them on all cylinders, but now we have to get people out there. We've put the work in. Now we got to get the word out there and get people coming out. So what do we do? Our email, our marketing plan. So we don't do anything that I think is outside the norm of many businesses, TV, weekly emails. We do a member of the month to talk a little bit about. We have a couple trade magazines, golf shows, and so on and so forth. And we'll kind of go through a couple slides here that just detailing what we did in marketing. TV exposure. So the one thing that we did, each and every year we try to launch a different and new campaign to not be like the typical stale commercial. So this year we did cameos of our staff at each and every property. So Jimmy Kepler, our new general manager out there this year, we had him highlighting Eagle Valley with a golf shot. And then at each and every one of our properties, we had staff at the property in the commercial. So super excited about that. I think the staff got a real kick out of it because as soon as they were on TV, all the phones are blowing up like, hey, I just saw you on TV. So it was pretty cool. I know Jimmy's phone did too. It was funny. Social media, we have a gal that oversees us for our entire company. Eagle Valley was all over Facebook and Instagram promoting just about everything we did for the company. So she did a great job this past year on that. Member of the Month, this is something that we do at each and every one of our clubs. People fill out a data capture sheet. They click which one they want to belong to. Most of them always click all of them, which is fantastic because we can put them in all of our databases. But they get unlimited golf for a month. It's a very easy commodity for us to give away. They typically do not come to golf by themselves. We announce them in our email blast, and when we do that, their friends go, hey, Jimmy, I can't believe you won member of the month. Let's go golfing. So it's a pretty fantastic deal. We have relationships with Flowing Tide and Sierra Gold in Reno, and we're getting ready to get more involved with Bullies, which is down here and kind of going to bring the people south. But member of the month, we did it in our restaurant and at some local clubs in Reno. Golfing Nevada, this is a magazine that hits all of our surrounding states. Really well done publication. So Eagle Valley was highlighted in Golfing Nevada. Gold Dust West, we've had a great relationship with Gold Dust West. They were super excited that we were coming into Eagle Valley, have continued to be really excited, really repaired that relationship with Eagle Valley and Gold Dust West. They do a fam tour where they bring out premier clients and customers that they want to have a tournament. We hosted one last year, booked two tournaments. We're getting ready to host one in a week or two, and hoping for the same success. So with that relationship with Gold Dust West, they advertise on our golf carts now and are a huge partner of the golf club. Fred Alexander Jr. Clinic, that's been going on for many years there. We've continued it. I've had it 2 years now. 350 some odd kids come out there, parents, big bleachers there. Great junior program, and we've continued that since we've been there. Aces games. We have two nights throughout the Aces season where we have a booth right at the entry. Eagle Valley was highlighted on that, where we have a giveaway, a data capture, and we give rounds of golf out to all of our golf facilities, but Eagle Valley was one of those highlighted in that Aces program. Golf shows and expos. We attend between 4 and 6 golf shows a year, as far away as Fort Worth, Texas, to Portland, Oregon. This year, I think we did 4, a couple more local ones, but Eagle Valley is represented in each one of those golf shows. Boys, so we talked a little bit about this. We did a Father's Day promotion. It was our second year doing it. And Boys, ironically enough, seems to have a restaurant around each and every one of our golf courses, including Eagle Valley, which is right here. The one thing that we did see with this is that, hey, there is also one on Mount Rose Highway, which is the one that's close to here. So Eagle Valley got some exposure through the Boys restaurant. We love that clientele. It's really our clientele as well, those sports bar folks. So we're super excited about that relationship. Eagle Valley was promoted online with Boys. It was fantastic. We did a legislator ad this past year. We did not get a lot of redemption, but what we did get is a lot of exposure to these folks that are in town for a period of time, that came out, frequented the golf course, but not super successful on the redemption, but we felt good to just get in front of those people that we wouldn't have been prior to. High school, Carson High School, we were in about our 4th or 5th month at Eagle Valley. We were approached by the high school team. They wanted some turf expertise. So we went over there, we met with them, helped out a little bit with the field, and lo and behold, throughout that conversation, what they really wanted was some help and mechanical. So they had some very old machinery. We went back. TJ Duncan, very close with the coach there, very passionate for Carson High, and we decided to donate a large rough mower, which helped improve their outfield for the season. And in exchange for that, we got to advertise with them. We're partners, a big sponsor of Carson Baseball. So in our marketing, what we believe is our most effective marketing piece that we do is we send out a weekly email. It's kind of funny. When we get to the off season, we don't send them out nearly as often because we don't have many things going on, and we get these replies all the time, like, hey, when are you going to send out an email? What's going on? Hey, there's snow on the ground. Relax. But so this is one of our most successful marketing campaigns and most interactive with the customer. So Eagle Valley benefited from our program there, and we'll continue that in the future. I'm going there. This past year, we had the Concert Under the Stars. Jimmy Kepler, Tom Duncan, the entire staff did a lot of work up and to this event, and holy moly, it was super successful. There's a lot of work put in 2018 to have this pull off in 2019. We signed a 2-year agreement. I don't think they ever want to go anywhere else. They knocked it out of the park. I think there was 1,200, 1,300 people. And it was really flawless. The parking, they just did an amazing job all the way around. So we have that next year. Super excited for what that brings. A lot of the community leaders out there and about it, and it was fantastic. So what did that all produce? Well, Eagle Valley, for the first time in its most recent history, turned a profit last year. We are super excited about that. A huge turnaround from where the property was to where it is today, and then where it's going in the future. Although we had some ambitious budget goals going in, we didn't meet those on the top line revenue, but we did exceed $1.4 million, and we were very excited about that. As of the end of July, We are forecasting and expected to crest $1.5 million, which is a pretty good accomplishment in year two. So we're excited about where 2019 is going to finish. I'm good there. The future is bright at Eagle Valley. Super excited. Tom Duncan has a amazing passion for Eagle Valley. This is where he raised his family. We first went into Eagle Valley with, hey, we're going to support this. We're going to do this. It was successful. It continues to be successful. We're excited for the future of Eagle Valley. Through the profits that we earned in our first year, we get to put $6,000 into the Eagle Valley Capital Fund. Our memberships are sustained and holding at 100 full members, which we're terribly excited about. That's pretty awesome. The start of 2019, if everyone can remember, it's pretty hot now. We're finally getting summer now. But it was a slow start with all the snow cover that we had down here. Once we got going, Eagle Valley is now in excess of 1,300 paid rounds ahead of last year, which we are super excited about. The driving range is exceeding revenues by 5,000. And then this past year, we added Jimmy Kepler back to the staff as general manager, and he splits his time with Eagle Valley and Dayton Valley, really pulling those two communities in. And we think that 2020 is going to be phenomenal. So we're super excited. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. That's quite a turnaround. A lot of hard work, sounds like it, guys, did. Appreciate it.
Continues to be.
Any commissioner comments or questions? All right. Anybody?
Sure. So what do you think your challenges are for the next year, now that you have a little over a year under your belt? What do you see the challenges to be able to maybe meet those projections?
You know, I do think the hard work is pretty much done. I think that the challenge, as in anything in Northern Nevada right now, is hiring good and retaining good staff. That's always our challenge in the seasonal market. But the future's bright. We don't see any big hurdles coming. We feel like we've really gotten over those. We feel pretty good. We really do.
I have a question. I know at one time there was a restaurant out there. Is the restaurant in operation, and would that be considered a draw, or does that generate any sufficient revenue to?
It does. Yeah. No, there's a restaurant, full bar and restaurant there, and it does, and we're working towards making that a little bit better. It's kind of off the beaten path, so it doesn't have the exposure that you would at a normal restaurant front, but it does okay. It's really the golfer that's going to frequent the restaurant. It's not super convenient getting in and out of there. You at the park, kind of walk across a long parking lot. So there's challenges at any golf course restaurant, to be quite honest with you. We use those to really facilitate golf and not really run those as a true food and beverage. So.
Anybody else have any questions, comments? I guess not. It was excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you. See you again.
All right. We are moving on to a public comment. Thank you for that. Any public comment on this item? All right. Hearing none, let's move on to agenda item 3C for discussion only, a presentation regarding pickleball participation in Carson City, infrastructure needs, fundraising efforts, cooperation with other user groups, and potential outdoor pickleball opportunities within Carson City. And our very own Commissioner Whitfield is going to do this presentation.
Thanks, Madam Chairman. My name is Dave. I'm an addict. I'm a pickleball addict. Thanks to the chair and the commission and the director for giving me a few minutes to talk about my addictive sport. I'm hoping that some of the people in the group here know what pickleball is, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about that. We got a program started about 3 years ago, thanks to Dan Arp and Scott Chapman at the MAC, and some local pickleball players had an introductory class to get people to learn about pickleball and teach some pickleball, and I was fortunate enough to attend that. And my wife and I have become pretty active in the sport since then. It draws a lot of former tennis players. I would say probably half of our participants are former tennis players, and I think I see some of my tennis friends in the group tonight. So I'm glad you guys could make it. I do want to talk about pretty much the topics that were outlined. In terms of participation, we have about 100 Carson City pickleball players right now on my email list. So that's a distribution that I send to pretty regularly. A typical day at the MAC, which is our indoor facility, draws between 20 and 60 players, depending on the day, the time, and the season. We get a lot more participation in the winter, of course, because we can't play outside. And the outside play is what I really want to focus on, one of the things I want to focus on tonight. We have a lot of tennis courts in town. Not all of them are playable. And I understand the tennis community is concerned with that, and I believe the commission is also concerned with that, and we certainly want to address that. However, there are some good tennis courts in town that can be played, where people can play tennis. Unfortunately, we really have no dedicated outdoor pickleball facilities. There are some tennis courts in town that have lines for pickleball marked on them, but they use the existing tennis net, and those nets have to be strapped down to meet the regulations for pickleball, and that's not convenient for the pickleball players, and it's also kind of hard on the equipment, on the tennis equipment, so not ideal. Another problem with the markings that as they exist today is that they're really only one per tennis court, and since it's using the existing net, it leaves about 40 feet from the baseline of the pickleball court to the fencing. So this means that every time you miss a shot, you're running to the back fence to get a ball. So essentially, you spend more time chasing balls than you do playing pickleball. So that's not a very desirable thing. I'm hoping someday that we can, the city will see fit to build a complex. And right now we're looking, I think, at Mills Park as a possible location for that. With a minimum of 24 courts, we would be able to hold large regional tournaments, which has the potential for bringing a lot of revenue into the city. So that's my pitch on some of the infrastructure needs. As far as fundraising, we held a fundraiser recently at the MAC. That facility was nice enough to give us that the full gym for half a day. And we had 80 players that paid $20 a piece to play. So we raised about $1,600 there. We had additional donations from some of our players, and some of them were quite generous. So right now we've raised almost $4,000 for this little project that I'm going to tell you about. I want to make just a quick thank you to Jen and Dan and Scott. And the staff for their supporting this event. They were very helpful to us. And I don't want to forget to mention Costco. Costco gave us about $300 worth of goodies for the players to eat, and we had tables set up and pretty much ate all the food. So that was a pretty good deal. Moving right along, I want to talk a little bit about cooperation with the tennis group. I've had some discussions with some of the people in the audience tonight about cooperating. There is in some locations, there's tension between the tennis community and the pickleball community because of the different needs for each. It's my feeling, and I think this has been well received, that if we cooperate, we're more likely to get the facilities that each group really wants and needs. And so I'm continuing to work with anybody in the tennis community that's interested in improving facilities for both groups, and also inviting the tennis community, members of the tennis community, to try pickleball. We'd like to see you at the MAC. We I'm lucky enough to have a court at my house. We'd like to see some of you over there. So I hope you'll consider doing that. Of course, we'd all like to see improvements to the existing facilities, the tennis facilities, and I think that would go a long way toward reaching our goals for both sports. As I mentioned earlier about the MAC, we have in the MAC the best pickleball facility in Northern Nevada. It's a great gym, and the guys do, you know, and gals do a great job of running it. And we have a lot of time for pickleball. So we're very happy about that. But in contrast, we really have no outdoor facilities at all for pickleball that are really playable. I recently submitted a proposal and scope of work to the Parks and Rec Department to try to convert one or two of the unusable tennis courts at Mills Park. These would be the ones that are they're closest to the swim center. And they're really now in such bad shape that no one should attempt to play any sport on them at the moment. So the idea here would be to convert at least one of the courts to pickleball. And because of the dimensions of the courts, the way that works out, one tennis court can essentially provide the space for four pickleball courts. So what we'd like to do is strip the surface off of that one or both of those courts and patch the concrete to the best of our ability and then resurface that the concrete and add some permanent nets. We think that would cost us about somewhere in the neighborhood of $5,000 to $6,000 in materials. And we've proposed to do the work with volunteer labor. We've got quite a few volunteers in the group lined up to help us do that work. So that's been submitted. We don't have approval for that yet, but we're hoping to work out the kinks in that pretty soon. We are also looking at trying to get some matching funds from the Redevelopment Authority because I understand that Mills Park is in the one of the redevelopment zones and might be eligible for some matching funds, so I'm working that angle too. So what this would do in the short term would be provide some outdoor pickleball facilities and also give us a chance to demonstrate to the community and to the department the demand for those kinds of facilities. And hopefully, if we demonstrate enough demand, we could actually make a case for the revision of the master plan to Mills Park to include a pickleball complex. So that's my pitch for pickleball tonight, and I appreciate you listening to me ramble. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. Do any of the other commissioners have any questions? Commissioner Myers?
Have we looked into a sport court type product that we could go over those courts? I know we used that at the PEP for the roller hockey, and I know the products. I'm familiar with them from when I used to work at the Parks and Recreation Department. I'm sure they've improved. So
we have looked in that. Jennifer Budge, Parks and Recreation Director. We have looked into that. They're essentially some Band-Aids when you do that. And we've done that at Centennial. We've done that at other park facilities. And you only get about 4 or 5 years out of that. Long term, the staff really feels strongly about doing a post-tension concrete solution, so we have like a good 20 to 30 year fix. And then although it's more of a initial investment, it reduces our maintenance costs, which every 4 years we're searching for money. There's cracks, there's peeling. If you go to John Mankins Park right now, you can see that sport court application there, which is starting to fail. And it's a real problem throughout the entire park system. We completely recognize it, and we're working on a plan which will be a combination of things because we have severely aging infrastructure and it has to be multiple funding sources that solve the problem. So we're looking into USTA grants for tennis court improvements. Those would not be eligible for pickleball courts or any dual-use, dual-striping type complexes. USTA really wants to invest into the sport of tennis. So there's that option. There's also some private foundations that I'm aware of and have worked with previously that have invested into resurfacing and redoing tennis courts, and I want to pursue that as well. Also, we have, you know, Dave has been wonderful, and I really appreciate his solution-based approach. I mean, he's already out there. He has been on the Park Commission for a very short time. He's already had a fundraiser. He's already raised money. He's already identifying solutions, and we need that help. So I think it's sort of, you know, a combination of that. We can use quality of life funding in some of our facilities, but quality of life isn't eligible for every facility where we have tennis courts as well. But I think Dave is right. It's a cooperation between the tennis group, the pickleball folks, and working together on a big citywide plan. Where do we focus tennis? Where do we focus pickleball? And then where are there both opportunities accommodated? And we'll get into that too with the next item, which is Roscoe Park Master Plan, and we can also talk about that further. But I think we need a really good community-wide approach, not only for funding, but trying to be thoughtful. We can't replace everything that we have with the funding that we have, and that's just the unfortunate reality. The sport court is a great option, but it just, you're keeping having to do that every 4 to 5 years. So if you're going to do a $25,000 application every 4 to 5 years, we might as well have invested $60,000, $65,000 in a post-tension concrete that would last for 20-plus years. So we have had a couple different groups. Dave has helped us out as well. Different people that work with different applications to come and look at our courts and give us their best opinion. And we do have some hard quotes, so we can use that for grant applications or, you know, other projects as well. We can look at Land and Water Conservation Fund grants. If it's something about improving accessibility, there's community development block grant funds. We have a lot of options available, but we have so many projects we have to pick and choose, you know, where we apply really thoughtfully.
The May Foundation is one that's interested in. She already knew that because you're from Washoe County.
I love you. Yeah.
Any other comments?
I just like to say, yeah, we would appreciate any approach that would improve the conditions for both groups. As Jennifer mentioned, though, it is kind of a pay me now, pay me later proposition. If we invest wisely in the right solution for this climate, we potentially save a lot of maintenance money down the road. So that's
the sport court that you're putting out. Is that stay on the court year round, or is it a seasonal application?
Are you talking about the one at?
Well, any
at
of
the
them,
Marv Texera Pavilion, or are you talking about a permanent application?
Well, you said that it's over at the Silver Oak Park, John Mankins.
So at John Mankins, I thought you were talking about, are you talking about a temporary structure?
I'm talking about a temporary snap-together sport court
application. Oh, I apologize. I was thinking
And that sport court different. Application is what we have at the PEP, am I correct?
We do. And yeah, so that is now beyond repair. But the Sierra Inline Hockey League is the primary user of that flooring. They've actually done a community fundraising campaign to replace that surface. So it's something that they're purchasing their time, their dime. And we put it down for 7 months of the year through their lease agreement.
Well, my question, back to my original question, that product is sold in a porous type application, lets water through it and so forth,
yeah,
that you can put on to rehabilitate a tennis court or a surface that you want to put a basketball court on or something like that.
Yes, you can.
Has that been looked into? I guess was my question.
Partially, but we can look into that more and get some hard costs.
Because especially if we only put it out for 6 months and we had a volunteer base that would bring it up, put it back down, bring it up, yeah, and we could rehabilitate, yep, probably some courts for a lower fee, so a lower cost.
We can definitely look into that. I appreciate that, and I'm sorry, I thought you were talking about like the temporary application that goes over asphalt that only buys you about 4 years.
Understand.
Sorry.
Perfectly fine.
Quick comment on that, Commissioner Meyer. I looked into that for my own, for our quarter, our house. For pickleball, I won't speak to it to tennis. I think we have some people that could. I've played tennis on it. It's not ideal for tennis. It's okay. It's really not suitable for pickleball. The ball, the bounce on a pickleball is much less than on a tennis ball. And any irregularity in the surface that those tiles are put over creates dead spots. And the surface itself doesn't produce a good bounce to start with, even if it's perfect. And with the dead spots, it just makes it unplayable. So I think our court was 30 by 60, which is a traditional court size. And it's about $4,000 to $5,000 to put tiles on it. So I looked into that. And once I read the reviews and talked to other pickleball players that had tried it, I just decided that was not a viable solution.
Any other questions or comments from the commissioners? Hearing none, I'm going to open it up to public comment. Come on down. Introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, Madam Commissioner. Is it on? Yep.
Yeah, you're good.
And members of the commission, my name is John Paul Kyle. I've lived in Carson City since 1991, and my son is a tennis addict. And so I've had a lot of discussions with Dave about pickleball, and I've played pickleball a couple of times. I even bought a paddle recently, and I think it's a great sport. I think it's, and I'm recognizing that it is a burgeoning, exploding sport across the country and across our region. And I can see why that is happening. It's very a fun game to play. It's a great way to get out and play a game that is like tennis. But I just want to say that pickleball and tennis are completely different sports. They're completely different. And I want to talk about the demand for pickleball in Carson City versus, say, for example, the demand for tennis. The reason why we may be seeing a decreased demand for people playing tennis is because our courts are unplayable. And so I have a really difficult time seeing, listening to the argument that the tennis courts are not playable, so no one's playing tennis, but we want to play pickleball, so let's rebuild the courts to play pickleball. I have a difficult time with pickleball expenditures supplanting tennis expenditures. So I'd like to see both sports in town. I want to play both sports. My son and I have played both sports, but I don't want to see pickleball supplant tennis, and I don't want to see tennis supplant pickleball either. So we need to find a way to make both sports grow and for pickleball players to be able to have facilities for them to use, outdoor facilities. And I could say that conversely for tennis, there's no indoor tennis facilities at all. And the one indoor facility that was in our region in Reno, I understand, was recently went away. It was sold and converted to some other use. So I have the same problem Dave has with tennis, in that I don't have anywhere to play during the wintertime either at all. My son's coach is here, and he's willing to coach him and play tennis as long as the tennis balls don't freeze and fracture and splinter on the ground, and as long as my son is willing to wear a glove over his tennis racket. They're out there playing in freezing temperatures. As long as the tennis ball bounces, they'll play. But we need courts to play on. And what I'm seeing is potentially funding leaving the tennis area, and I'm seeing tennis courts go into disrepair. And as of the close of this meeting, my son will have lost two opportunities to play tennis, one at Mills Park and one at Ross Gold. So I don't want to see that go too far down the road. I understand we have limited resources to support both sports, but there is a demand for tennis, and I think there's other folks in the audience who want to express that demand. But don't mistake the lack of a tennis community because people aren't playing tennis. People are not playing tennis because the courts are in horrible condition. They haven't been touched since 2000, whatever. It's been a decade or more since the tennis courts have been addressed. And it's time for them to be addressed. And then also, I would like to, I think it could be really fruitful if we could have a specific agenda item with, by this commission to specifically talk about the different ways to rehabilitate the courts in town. I think there's not universal agreement that post-tension concrete is the way to go. I think there are other options that need to be discussed. For example, the court services that you were talking about, Kurt, I think they existed at Centennial 15 years ago. They were on the courts there. And you know, if you're a tennis player, if that's what you got, then you'll play on it, but it's not the ideal surface. So I think tennis players and pickleball players, we want the ideal surface. We want safe play areas. We want outdoor play areas. Boy, it'd be great if we could play in the wintertime, but I know that's another discussion completely. So that's what I have to say.
Thank you so much. I believe Commissioner Bagwell has a comment or a question.
So maybe a comment actually for both of you, and maybe it really dovetails in with our discussion at Roskill Park. So for me, I'm looking for is how do I fit both needs? So probably you're not both going to get everything that you want because there isn't enough money for that. So when we look at these master plans for all of the parks, including one we're going to be doing for Fuji, is, and it's no different than the number of playgrounds that we need in all of the parks. And so I really look for us as the Park and Rec Board to look at things not singularly. So part of my concern about looking at like just Roskill Park or just Mills Park is we're not looking at the whole picture and coming up and saying, okay, I need to meet the tennis needs. I need to meet the pickleball needs. I need to meet the dog park needs. I need to, and that we really should be aiming this slightly different. For me, I'd like to see the list of what we want in our parks, how many playgrounds are appropriate, and that I need to know how many tennis courts do I need. Could I pretend 10 courts, and that would accommodate. So if 10 courts are what I'm trying to accomplish, then where can I master plan that and concentrate that effort, and how many do I need for pickleball? And so is there 8 of those? 12 of those, and is there, and right. So I just caution us while we look at some of these master plan ideas is that we get the rest of the picture so that we don't make mistakes master planning something and then we don't have anywhere to put something that we need. So I just caution us to keep all of this. And then I want to thank both pickleball and the tennis group, because I know they have raised a lot of money, even though there's no way to charge going into a tennis court, but you created a club, and you charge a membership fee, and then you have done nets, and you reinvest and put the money back in. And I know, again, we have a later agenda item dealing with fees, too, and it's very difficult in some of our parks because they're open. But I just want to thank you both on the record for recognizing it takes the user groups to try and make it happen. So I don't want to not thank you for all of your hard work. And I'm sure that all of us as great minds can come up with a tennis solution and a pickleball solution.
Yeah, I'd like just to respond to that, Mr. Kyle. I agree with what you said about the sports being very different. We've had some discussion, I've had some discussion with Director Budge about what might be an appropriate allocation of resources for both groups. The initial discussion on this is centered around Centennial. It kind of has the tennis community kind of recognizes that as the place for tennis, at least historically in town. So one thought that has been mentioned is to continue with that, but improve the situation there, and then perhaps allocate another space dedicated to pickleball, such as Mills Park. We don't know if that's the space or not, but that's one that's under discussion So if we were able to move forward in planning, like Commissioner Bagwell mentioned, I think we have some opportunities to say what would we do in dedicated spaces and then address what would we do in the neighborhood parks, because they might be different. We might do something in dedicated space that would be different than what we could offer players. I suspect that more casual tennis players may play in the neighborhood parks, and the more serious maybe at Centennial. Mm-hmm. And I think you could probably say the same if we had a dedicated space at Mills for pickleball, then probably the more serious players would play there, and perhaps less serious players would play in the neighborhood parks. So maybe we can share spaces along those lines. But I agree with you that we need to have this discussion, and I thank you for coming forward and speaking tonight. We appreciate it.
Let's keep talking, and I think it'd be really valuable, again, to have that discussion that dedicated on the different ways to address infrastructure needs and maintenance, because I don't think there's agreement among everyone about how to best do that. I don't think everybody agrees on the concrete idea necessarily. It might be too pie in the sky. You may not be able to get that plane off the ground because it's so expensive to begin with. Even though the maintenance is a better ideal, if you can't make that plane fly, then that means we've got so many courts that are still unplayable in town. So, and with respect to inventory and how many courts we need, I can tell you that we need more tennis courts than we have now because so many are in disrepair. You can't count those ones that are in disrepair as part of your court inventory, if you will. So there's lots more to talk about. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it. Any other public comments on this item? Come on down.
I have a quick question. Have they ever thought of repairing and redoing the two courts that used to be at the Boys and Girls Club?
You have to come up. Ma'am, let this lady talk, and then you're going to have to come up and ask your question, please. Because it's a public meeting, and we'd like you to have your name for the record. Okay, would you introduce yourself?
I'm Diane Baker Roberts. I lived here all my life. I've been on the quite a few years back with Carson Tennis Club. I guess I could say I'm the president of the tennis club. The tennis club doesn't really exist right now. We can't charge dues, and I mean, I'm talking minimal, $40 a year. And they're gonna, why? We used to give them balls to play with, free balls, tennis balls, on Saturdays, and those are still in my garage. But, we called those egg crates, what Kurt talked about. Okay, we had those in Carson City on our tennis courts. This gal back here probably remembers. I'm trying to think if they were at Mills or at, we had a court or two with those. They're horrible. Douglas High School had all those, we call them, I don't know the name of them, but, you know, the temporary topping. Douglas High School, they're horrible for tennis. And like Dave says, pickleball is even worse because there's a wiffle ball in pickleball, different ball. And maybe as I age, 10 years ago, I would have said, those pickleball people aren't coming on our courts in Carson City. Well, that we need to get along. And I play pickleball. I play pickleball down in Mesa, Arizona. I've played pickleball here. I just had a knee replacement. I'm not doing a whole lot right now. We do need to work together. And I wish there were more tennis people here because I don't think they understand what's going on at Centennial. There's a water problem, water damage. I don't know the proper verbiage. A tennis player, I can't say a member, said to me, well, I would have them resurface it anyway. Who cares about the water problem? Well, they just, we're looking at getting better sports courts to Carson City, and yes, to last longer. And I know the salesman that came and spoke to you. I didn't know about this meeting until yesterday, and that's probably my own fault. I've sort of been out of the loop with surgeries and a few things. They have those at Lake Ridge tennis courts. I don't know how many are there, but I would be happy to go on a trip with you over there. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that if you have $65,000 per court, but I'm going to be dead and buried by the time we have those $65,000 courts out at Centennial Park. And I'm in my early 60s. I mean, I totally agree with Dave. There's something that can be done. He was only talking about one court at Mills Park. And he has the measurements. He's correct. One tennis court. Okay, this is a tennis court in Carson City. Four pickleball courts can be constructed or lined on one tennis court. Okay? And it is hard to play tennis on a court lined in pickleball. But I've done it in Palm Desert. It's possible. And I'm a very avid tennis player. If you want a tennis court, you're going to play on it. We have at Centennial Park, which is used to be the nucleus for tennis here in Carson City. Those weren't there when I was growing up. I learned to play on a wall at Carson Junior High School and then Mills Park. And then Skipper Wall and some other people in town got those up and running. Carson High School, I coached there for 32 years. We used those courts for years because we didn't have them at the high school. Carson High School destroyed four courts that are now a parking lot. This was years ago, and we were shipped out there again. Carson High School put in eight brand new courts in about 2006. It was only coincidental that I was the athletic director at the time and the tennis coach, but that was just coming. It was a timely matter. Those courts were just resurfaced by Stapleton with Color Crafters, who has done work out here for $50,000, including he put in very expensive nets at $275 a piece. We buy about $180 nets for our club. But it's not a cheap fix, whatever you do. I've offered Carson Tennis Club's money, about $15,000 right now, is with Foundation for Carson City Parks and Rec, 501c3. And I guess I control that money, but we've offered the city $10,000 if it would help fix two courts at Centennial. And I know a lot of people that played at Roscoe. I don't even think Roscoe is playable right now. I haven't been out there. The people that play out there, some men play there the opposite days of this ladies group, and they said, we need new nets. I said, I will buy you a new net if you pay your dues. I'll buy you a net out there. Well, I could go out there tonight. I have a net in my garage. We can't put a new net on those courts. The posts are round. They're older. The new nets go on a square post, and the nets don't crank out there because they've been vandalized, it's hard to, I don't know the word. We can't lock up the courts, but that's an idea for the future in the evenings. But we can't put new nets at Ross Gold because there's no crank to tighten the tension. I'd go out there and put it up myself if it could be done. So when all courts are redone, you put in new net posts and they're a square, 4x4, whatever. I do think Ross Gold, would be an easier fix than some of Centennial. There's no water damage, I guess. I don't know. I would like to see those. There's a lot of people that come from Gardnerville and Lake Tahoe to play tennis in Carson City, and that's where they go. Some will come out to Centennial. In the winter, we play in the winter. We shovel the snow and we play. I've played in 3 years. You just play in the wintertime. As we get older, no, we don't want to. But Lake Tahoe people come down here, and if they don't play at Douglas High School, they're going to come to Ross Gold or Centennial Park. I live up in Silver Oak. That court was built the wrong direction years ago. They talked to Pat Houlihan and myself at Carson High School. We told them all courts in the world are north-south, and they built it east-west. So you're a good tennis player. I taught there for years. I ran a tennis program until I got about 30 or 40 kids. And I can handle 30 on a court at a time, but they're little, and then I had to move back out to Centennial. But the sport court there, it is ruined. The sprinklers at one time, but in the past 15 years, when I go by there, I stop and I kick people off the court. They're playing soccer, and I've gotten antagonized by you know, I don't carry a gun and those people might. I'm not going to do it anymore. I put my own personal net straps up on that court. But I totally agree. We need to work with the pickleball people. I see myself going to all pickleball in the next 10 years. I love them both. And I see the fix that his association has, and I just don't know how it works with the city. You know, they will do the work. They will change the court four, but the furthest west court into four pickleball courts. And I think if the tennis people saw that, you know, right? I think the other courts at Mills Park were maybe lined for pickleball years ago, because I know Joanne and Gary Sharon had that done. And I've taught lessons there, and I've played there since that's done. It's, you know, it's doable. But I think what I look at, and it's not, it's just what I'm thinking, if we could have two tennis courts at Mills and eight pickleball courts, if Carson City just saw that, it would bring people here. We ran a tournament every year out here not that many years ago we get California people because they're all involved in, like, Tahoe tennis. I ran a junior tournament at the high school and Centennial, over 260 players, with Pat Houlihan and myself. You can add Dennis Brinson's youngest was involved, was playing. It could have been Spencer, I'm not sure, but and we did it, and it was all by hand. We didn't have the computers that did your court assignments and everything, so it can be done. But we used to have our high school players play at a tournament with the club, and we used to have father daughter, you know, mother son, and we just can't do it anymore. We could run it at the high school, and the high school courts, years ago, they did have an agreement with the city. During the school day, somebody can't go in and play tennis at the high school because of security. But they can at Douglas, which I don't understand. It's a different county. But on the weekends, in the past, I've given people the code to get into Carson High School. I've given them a key to the courts. Actually, some fellow still has a key. don't put that in the newspaper. But it can be done. And I would like, you know, any of you, I would invite you down. I'll take you to show you. For $50,000, they resurfaced the courts at Carson High School. Were they as bad as Centennial? No, but I know there's some water damage there. And FEMA isn't, you know, a lot of our tennis players don't understand. FEMA came in. It's not just a quick surfacing and let's play tennis. And I understand that, and a lot of tennis people don't. I don't think all of Carson City needs 12 tennis courts and maybe some pickleball lines. I just totally agree. If we want Mills Park to be all pickleball, you know, and I think eventually, Centennial, people aren't going to want to hear this, but there's eight courts. Six are tennis. Take two of those courts. You have eight pickleball courts and six tennis courts in one facility with restrooms. You have a gold mine. So I don't like to public speak. So that's,
thank you so
anyway.
Much. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Commissioner Meyer?
I have a couple things. So first off, the joint usage agreement that we have with the Carson City School District.
I don't know.
We have one, but yeah. It always seems to be the wrong way. I don't work for Parks and Recreation anymore, and I don't have any kids at the Carson School District, so I can say this. They used our courts forever. No, they used our tennis courts forever. They built their own tennis courts. Now we're not able to use them.
I think that's wrong.
That's my point exactly. The joint usage agreement has to go both ways. It has to go
agree.
The same way
that
it goes
in
Douglas County.
Anymore, so.
I mean, we have, how many courts are over there?
Douglas High School, four.
No, over here.
Carson High, eight.
There's eight beautiful courts are empty more than they're not.
Well, right now it's tennis season, so from 2:30 to 5, you're right.
But empty more than they're not. And it's silly that they sit there empty and we can't use them. But before those courts were there, they used all our courts and pushed people like you off of the courts. So,
Before people were coming in on the weekend, and the vice principal at Carson High and head of athletics, he's gone now, Pat Houlihan, but he was letting people use those courts on the weekend.
Well, it probably wasn't advertised, and it was probably a select few. But anyway, I think the joint usage agreement should go both ways.
I agree, and I don't know what it is. There's no question about it.
That's why we have the joint usage agreement.
I agree wholeheartedly.
If we have to open the can of worms, I think we should open the can of worms and spill it all over the floor and let everybody in Carson City, whose tax dollars go to both sides of the coin, participate in that discussion.
Excuse me a minute. I think our counsel wants to say a word.
Ben Johnson, Deputy District Attorney for the record. Just 2 points. I think that we're straying a little bit far off topic. And the second is, I believe that the recorder is having trouble with the back and forth, just not to talk over one another because it can't be recorded. If it can't be recorded, then we can't put it in the minutes or anything like that.
So, Ben, would you suggest that maybe we schedule this for another meeting and have more time?
I think that would be an excellent suggestion. That way that you don't have to limit it to three-minute comment. Okay. And you can be more fully explored.
Sorry.
I apologize for the back and forth. I had a little passion there.
No, but
but that's what I'm known for.
That needs to be looked at through you and the school district.
Okay. So we can schedule this for another meeting, and we can give it a little longer time, and we can have all aspects, joint use agreements, pickleball, tennis courts, where the funding might come from, best repair type things, everything.
That'd be great. I could make myself available if it's not during the winter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and my apologies for opening the can of worms. I hope to keep this short and save this for another day. So thanks to Council.
Well, thank you. I didn't plan on coming up here until I heard about
that. I will comment that the Board of Supervisors and the school board have joint meetings. At the last joint meeting that we just had, I requested the use of the tennis courts. So I'm waiting for a response from the school district. But just so that you know, we did ask at the last joint meeting for that very
And who is the issue. Person? Is it the superintendent or somebody
Yeah, they
else?
Were at the meeting. It was a joint school board meeting, issue that was just brought up. So we'll follow up on that and get back with you.
Great.
Jen, can we put this on a future agenda, maybe a more in-depth discussion of the subject?
We'd be happy to, and then I'll follow up with some of the citizens that commented today to get some more information about the surface types that they'd like us to pursue, so we make sure that we're looking at the whole thing, and then we'll bring back the funding options as well.
Excellent. Ma'am, did you want to come down and ask your question about the Roop Street courts? Or? Okay, come on down.
We're not scared. Not
the city. They're state-owned, aren't they?
They're state-owned. Yeah. We can't touch them. Yeah. They're not ours.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
First, we have to go to Douglas County to play tennis because the courts are so
bad. Ma'am, could you introduce yourself, please?
Oh, do what?
Introduce yourself for the record.
Okay, I'm
Diane. It's a public meeting, so.
I am Diane Cox. I've lived here since 1966.
Okay. And you had a question about the Roop Street?
Yeah, those courts of the Boys and Girls Club used to be.
But they're state-owned. They're not city-owned, unfortunately.
Well, that's sad.
It is. But is there somebody we could reach out and chit-chat with, maybe, Jen?
I could contact State Lands and see if there's any interest. My understanding is the former Parks and Rec director did pursue that and didn't have much luck. But I am willing to try. They're not in great condition either, but
no, they're not. But you know, with that,
we know a former employee in the back of the room.
Okay,
that could probably help us.
Just a minute. Let's finish with Diane, and then we'll take you again, and then we're going to wrap it up.
Just want to say that we have to go to Douglas County to play tennis.
Yeah, that's what you were telling me at the open house out at the fire station.
We used to play Ross Gold,
and you were telling me those courts are not.
Nobody wants to use them because they are kind of.
Okay.
Full of cracks. They didn't do a very good job. And I have people that come from Carson Valley to play in Genoa and Minden, and it's a long way to drive out to Centennial.
Exactly, but this is.
I don't mind driving Centennial, but for them it's a long way.
So would you be happy? We're going to put this on a future agenda item and have a more in-depth discussion. Would you be willing to come to that meeting?
I don't want discussion. I want something done. I want those courts repaired before we're dead.
Well, let's get a game plan so that we can fix them properly and everybody can enjoy them for a long time, not just for a couple years.
Right, and we do play tennis in the winter. In the last 10 winters, 15 winters, they haven't been, you know, that bad here.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, that's it.
Well, we'll reach out and we'll find an answer to your question. Do you want to come on down, Mr. Kyle?
For the record, again, John Paul Kyle. Many of you may know that where those where the Boys and Girls Club in the state property is, where those tennis courts are, and there's also an old paddle ball court there, by the way, as well. That is on state property, and all of that property is planned as part of a larger capital complex. And there's many different kinds of state buildings, parking garages, office buildings, and other infrastructure that's part of this large master plan for this capital complex project. That is what is planned to go in on that, on those parcels whenever there's money to build it.
So that means that the state's not willing to put anything into those because eventually they'll be torn down?
I don't think you'll see anything happening to that property for a long time. So thank you again for letting us come to the meeting, and I look forward to future discussions.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much. We appreciate you coming on down, taking time out of your day. All right. Any other public comment on this item? Hearing none, let's move on to agenda item 3D, discussion and possible action regarding a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors regarding the Ross Gold Park Master Plan. Jennifer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jennifer Budge, Parks and Recreation Director. I'm pinch hitting for Vern Cron, our park planner, so I do want to just take a moment to thank him for spearheading this whole effort and the public process that went with it. So Ross Gold Park Master Plan. So it's originally called Southside Park. It's located in the southeast side of Carson City on Snyder. It was acquired in the 1960s from BLM through a recreation public purpose lease patent process. So we do have the patent and ownership of that property as long as we stick to what we said we would do with that property. It was developed in the 70s and the 80s, and the majority of the park infrastructure is actually original. The playground that we just put in was an original. It was over 35 years old. So you can see how dated that park is. It was developed with residential construction tax and a land and water conservation fund grant originally, which deed restricted the property for future park use. And it was renamed later on after when it, Ross Gold is a parks, former park superintendent, former employee of the Parks Department. And then it's also on one parcel. It's a 7.8-acre parcel. And on the parcel is Carson City Dispatch and then Fire Station 53. So they are our part of our design considerations as we move forward. As I just mentioned, we have significantly aging infrastructure, you know, not only throughout our park system, but this one in particular, because it is one of the city's oldest parks. It has, as I mentioned before, original and aging infrastructure. And we've been really looking at the age of the equipment and trying to leverage what funding that we do have with grant funding to try to reimagine that space. And that's what this process is really doing, is let's take what we have, try to reimagine it, meet today's needs, because the plan of the 60s might not meet what people want today, and try to really reinvigorate that park and make sure that it's safe. The city just replaced the playground with the city's first universally accessible playground in the city. It's tremendous. It's super popular. People are really enjoying it. And it's it was funded by a community development block grant, a land and water conservation fund grant. We had private donations and residential construction tax. So it was a lot of efforts to try to make just the playground happen. We had to remove the wood picnic shelter that was there, also part of that 60s and 70s investment in that park. We had the city's building official look at it. It was rotting from the footings up to the structure. It was sinking on one end, and it became a potential public safety risk, so we did take that down. We have received an additional community development block grant to rehabilitate the existing restroom. The restroom is surrounded is surrounding a well house. So it's primarily a well house, but also serves as a restroom. It's not ADA compliant because it was built in the 60s and the 70s. There were no ramps required or ADA requirements at that time. But now that we've built this universally accessible structure, we want to provide other facilities that are accessible as well. So we have secured that grant. We're just waiting on that notice to proceed, and then we'll get going on renovating that restroom structure. Some other amenities at Roscoe Park, to just give you a picture, we do have two tennis courts, we have horseshoe pits, and then we have a pond. A lot of people refer to this park as Duck Pond Park. If you hear that and you're wondering which park are they talking about, it's this park here. So it's actually an irrigation pond. It's not designed to be an urban fishing pond like Bailey's Pond is. We get a lot of people that dump koi and carp and other non-native wildlife in there, and it creates issues. So when we have an irrigation problem because of the old age of the infrastructure, and we've had to drain that pond and we've had to do repairs, then you see a lot of non-native species introduced to that pond. So it's not designed to be an urban fishing pond. It had a clay liner at one point. It's significantly failing. We are having water loss. We're trying to work with Public Works to measure that and mitigate that. But the pond is a source of concern. There's a lot of wildlife that do enjoy it. We get a lot of avian wildlife that come in. But there are some water quality issues with that pond, and we are using that to recirculate and use as a part of our irrigation system. But the primary function of that pond is an irrigation pond, not an urban fishing pond. So I just want to make that clear. As part of the master plan process, we did some public outreach. We had an online survey to just start off the process. We had 134 responses. You have some of those that feedback in your packet. Based on those responses to the survey, we created a preliminary draft, just a drawing for people to be able to look at and try to, you know, reimagine that space as we talked about. And then we presented that draft concept plan at a public meeting. We had over 30 people show up. It was a great meeting, really good feedback. And then we revised that drawing again based on what we heard from the public. We had almost every neighbor came over. Commissioner Long attended. Commissioner Kiever was there. We had a really good response and some good conversation with the public about their concerns with the pond and the water quality, the flow of the park, the parking issues, the lack of investment in the infrastructure, and all of the concerns you've heard tonight. So we took that drawing, and then we have this drawing. I gave you hard copies in front of you, so you have a little larger one. I know it's hard to see on the screen. There's additional pictures at the back of the room. But to just give you some highlights of what's proposed on this draft plan, it reduces turf. We have a lot of water that we're using at a neighborhood park. I have real concerns about using potable water on turf that's not used for sports complexes and has a lot of population, I guess, driven. So I want to still provide turf and still have that experience, but have a balance of native landscaping and turf. So that's sort of the direction we heard from citizens and staff. And so that's what the concept is. So it's still having a turf-focused area for multi-use. You can go kick around the soccer ball with your kids. You can have a volleyball game, you can have badminton, you can do whatever and utilize that turf, but it does reduce a lot of the water use and has sort of a native landscape buffer around the entire park. This would improve parking. We have the formal parking at the bottom of your screen, and it is in need of repair. The parking lot is deteriorating and needs attention. But if you go there on the weekend, especially when we had that pavilion in use, that parking lot is packed and people are impeding on the neighborhood. So we wanted to have some more formal parking because it is a larger site. A traditional neighborhood park is usually 1 to 3 acres. This is much larger. So we need to be able to accommodate and separate uses so we don't impact the neighbors negatively. Also, this plan talks about reinvesting in the park. We really want to have a good, thoughtful plan, and I'd love to take this plan and use it for grants and use it for foundations to invest in this facility. But it's important that we have a picture of what we want to try to achieve. We do need, as I said, the picnic shelter was probably the number one issue for people as I met with them. The second issue is the tennis and pickleball opportunities. But having that shade structure, it was a first come, first serve facility. and everybody had their birthday party there, family picnics, and it was really a heavily used facility. So we'd like to put another structure in its place, and we picked a little better location, we think, in the drawing that you see there. So this concept would provide dual sports courts. In the different versions and iterations we had of this plan, first we had tennis, then we had dual striping, then we had people wanted where we have the parking shown below those, adding courts. But it is a neighborhood park, and I don't want to create a regional facility in someone's neighborhood. So I don't want to draw too many people into this neighborhood and really negatively affect that park. So after the public meeting and the survey, we felt that this was the best compromise, is to provide four dedicated pickleball courts, which is one footprint of a tennis court, and then one dedicated tennis court. And we fully recognize that those courts need to be resurfaced, and in a thoughtful way, whatever application that ends up being. It has new shade shelters. There's beautiful trees on site at this park. In no way does this plan propose taking any trees out. We would meander the trail and the path that goes around the park and all of those amenities around those existing trees. So while you might have one picture here out in the field, it'd be a little bit different, and we'd work around those constraints. But there's some beautiful vegetation on site that we would want to preserve. This has a path connecting, and everything would connect to that playground, to the tennis courts. There's a better flow proposed than what's out there right now. The path is really beyond repair. It's kind of disjointed. There's not really a natural flow to the park. So I think this accommodates that. This would also abandon the existing pond, but create a new, we'll call it a water feature, that would still supplement the irrigation needs, but wouldn't have the water quality issues and the size, and it would reduce the impacts from the geese. There's a lot of feces at this park because of the pond. There's no aeration in the pond. You do get mosquitoes. There's just not a lot of flow. So this would make a little bit more sense in doing that, and then you'd still have that pond component that people do love. So it would address the water quality issues, and then it relocates activities. So if you look at the bottom right-hand side of your screen, that's where the existing horseshoe pits are, and we're proposing locating that at the other end of the park. We had a lot of comments and desire for bocce ball. Those two sports really can accommodate next to each other. They're really passive. Could be a great Eagle Scout project. We could actually get that done pretty quickly. But one thing we do have is we do have some flooding in the area, and this is a site that Public Works drops sand and shovels, and people go and fill their own sandbags at this location. This is one of those locations, and that happens in the parking lot, and it doesn't really work well when you have a really busy park and then half of your spaces are taken up from sand and people are actively trying to get in and out and do that. So that area right now on the bottom right-hand side where the existing horseshoe pits are, we're proposing that be like a stockpile area that we could provide that service to people. So they'd have a dedicated place they could pull right up, they could fill their sandbags and then get on their way. And then that way it wouldn't take up the needed parking that we have right now. But it would still accommodate those sports uses. And then it's just sort of separating uses. We show at the top of your screen some off-street parking, but it would be on the parcel, those angled spaces, and then some dedicated parking for the pickleball and tennis area. So it sort of separates those uses. If you're at the playground or you're at the picnic shelter, you can park, at the parking that's on the bottom of your screen. But if you're enjoying pickleball or tennis, maybe you're at the other parking lot. So you're not impeding on each other's activities, because the site's large enough where we can kind of separate those uses if it's a busy summer day. I think that's all I had, and I'd be happy to answer any questions or concerns. If you think something isn't quite working, we're happy to go back to the drawing board.
Jen, I just want to say I and Commissioner Long and Commissioner Whitfield were all at that open house, if you will. You and Vern did a wonderful job, and Vern was wonderful in explaining things to people and getting them calmed down. So if we mean you're kicking the pond away, you explain that. Oh, that makes sense. So he did a great job. You did a great job. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. And I think the pond is a very emotional thing for people, and I fully recognize that. And we love the pond, but there are significant water quality issues and challenges with how it was designed and what the intent was. And we wanted to try to find a compromise to still have that, provide that pond, but have, you know, improve water quality, reduce the water usage for the city, and, you know, be really thoughtful about it because it is potable water. I want to be smart with our drinking water. I wish we had the opportunity to have effluent at some of these other sites, but we just unfortunately don't. So we want to try to be thoughtful and reduce that if we can.
Okay.
Thank you. So the neighbors have spoken. I think that's wonderful. Was this plan designed, is it fiscally constrained, or is this just the plan and we look at the budget later?
That's a really great question. Jennifer Budge, Parks and Recreation Director. We're sort of doing both. So we have invested some funding into this site already. The Board of Supervisors had authorized some residential construction tax. We still have some available. So this plan helps us prioritize what existing funding we have. I like to take every dollar that we have and try to leverage it with a grant if we can. But I would love to make some improvements fairly soon because we would have a plan in place. Knowing we have infrastructure that is struggling and a potential safety issue, I didn't get into parks to close parks or take amenities away from people. I want to provide those opportunities. But this approving this plan will help us prioritize what we're going to do first. Do we have the funding for this entire plan? No. But I think this is a great tool to be able to implement it and know what we're going to do next. I can tell you that the top three things I've heard from people, not only in the survey, but at the public meeting and the calls we received, were one, the shelter, two, the picnic and tennis facilities, and three is the pond. And after you talk to people about the pond and explain what's going on, they've been all in full support about a new direction with the pond. And I think we could probably look after some like water quality grants and some alternative funding that Parks typically doesn't go after, and we could work hand in hand with Public Works to maybe make something like that happen.
I have like three more things. Should I keep going or do you want to just keep rolling right through? Thanks again. Thanks for that answer. So I guess my second question is still in that budget arena. So I don't know if there's been an analysis. Will the new water feature have some cost savings because we don't have to do that maintenance and go out and clean duck poo all the time with staff? I like the numbers. They're
okay.
Very, very physical.
Somewhat prepared. Oh, thanks. I'm somewhat prepared on the number situation. So we have $57,369 left in residential construction tax that's already been identified and earmarked for Roscoe Park. So that's not all the available residential construction tax within the city. We could go back to the board and get some direction to spend some additional monies. We've obviously, the economy is going really well. We generate residential construction tax for every new home construction. So every new home that's constructed, we get up to $1,000 of residential construction tax for the city. We can spend it in neighborhood parks of 25 acres or less. So this is eligible for that funding source. As far as the pond goes, I do have cost estimates from Public Works because this is not my area of expertise. I don't want to pretend that I am an expert on that. But to remove the existing pond and then to put what's in place as proposed is about $575,000. To install the water feature and all that, just looking at that component, that's about 162. So I do have a detailed estimate from Public Works on what that would look like and based on what you have there.
And then will the new water feature reduce or eliminate some of the maintenance that we currently do at this park?
It would reduce that, and it would significantly reduce water, millions of gallons of water. So for me, that's, I think, the right thing to do for the city's drinking water. There is a well on site, but we also tie into the city's potable water system as well. So there's two water sources on site. The well provides water off site across town. So there's a pump station, and then it provides drinking water off site. So that's the other important thing, too, is because we don't want the water quality of the pond to negatively impact the well water and the source there. We have worked with Public Works and had them look at this water system. It's not There's no issues with this well on site. It's meeting all of the standards that it needs to meet. But that could be a potential issue if there's a problem with the pond. So it's going to improve water quality. It's going to reduce water, and it should reduce maintenance costs as well.
Commissioner Meyer?
With the plan that you have here, we're taking away a tennis court and putting a pickleball court. And most of the people that talked about tennis today say that this is the last remaining place where they like to play tennis because it's in great shape. So why couldn't we possibly, with the master plan, put another tennis court in there? No, not instead of pickleball. That's not at all. So we'd have a total of three areas. We'd have a pickleball area. We'd have two tennis courts. I mean, it just seems to, what we heard from everybody that came up here, this is their favorite place to go right now because it's, I suspect that it's probably their favorite because it's in the best condition. So with this master plan and you trying to take some of that green space away to save on water and so forth, could that be snuck in there or is that cost prohibitive?
Well, I think with money we can do anything. I do want to say that the courts are not in great shape here either, so I want to be very clear on that. There's a significant crack. We actually think there was an earthquake, and there's a fault that's really nearby that contributed to the cracking at this court, and it's not great. So it is usable, but it's continually deteriorating and does need to be addressed. So regardless of the existing condition, we almost need, I hate to say start from scratch, but we do need to address the condition of the courts. One of the other iterations that we had, well, we actually had two different iterations of this drawing. So the first was dual striping. We heard at the public meeting that was a big hot no. And then we had another iteration where we had where you have the current parking lot, we had putting some courts in there as well, so expanding that area. So I think that's a very real possibility. There's not a huge grade change in there. They wouldn't require a lot of dirt work to make an additional court happen over there because I think it's important to kind of keep that like a mini complex, if you will, and not have like a tennis court where the horseshoe pits are or and have separated uses. So if you did have a larger game or you had a group of people wanting to play, I think we could definitely accommodate that if you wanted to add an additional tennis court on there. It's just going to be additional money that we'll have to secure.
Well, I mean, from what I heard from the tennis people and also the pickleball lobby, I mean, we need tennis courts. And, of course, I'm a proponent of fixing what we have for sure. But at the same time, if this is a master plan, mm-hmm. why not put another tennis court in there? We're accommodating four pickleball courts and now only one tennis court. So just a comment on what I heard. So,
well, that's why we're here. We want your feedback, and we can always revise this before we go to the Board of Supervisors. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. Just to respond to Commissioner Meyer, I hate to turn down pickleball courts wherever they may be proposed, but there are some social differences between the tennis community and the pickleball community. Pickleball seems to generate larger participation when there's a concentration of courts, as in a complex that we've talked about for Mills. It's a little hard to explain if you haven't been in the community, but trust me, this is kind of the way it works. I hate to turn down courts, but I would be willing to give these courts up in exchange for moving on something in a concentrated area like a complex at Mills or something like that. The tournament play for pickleball almost requires that there be a concentration of courts. The other point I'd like to make is that the pickleball is typically played as a doubles game. There are singles, but 99% of the play is in doubles. So each court has four participants, and since you get four courts per tennis court space, that puts 16 people in the space where you'd normally have two or four tennis players. So, you know, even with eight courts, for instance, at Mills, you'd have a very high concentration of play. So, and I think that I kind of opened the door for the tennis people. I actually contacted the tennis people and asked them to come tonight. I didn't ask my pickleball people to come because I knew this was going to open a can of worms, and I wanted to hear from them first. And I knew this discussion might blow up. I hoped it wouldn't, but it kind of did. So I think these are things we could handle at a future meeting. But that's my two cents for now. Thank you.
Commissioner Long?
First of all, and I don't think it necessarily blew up. I think it's just discussions that need to be had. So I think what you're doing is great. I know we talked quite a bit about the pickleball kind of courts and like the dual lines. And one thing I had mentioned is, and this kind of question goes like onto what Kurt was mentioning. So when it comes to a master plan, is it acceptable for the master plan that because of the area, you could have both the surfaces and then decide to mark them whatever you want to mark them at any time? So is it reasonable that we can go on with the master plan and you could have a parking lot or tennis ball or tennis court area, or is it something like you can have it as an amendment later? I don't know what the timing is based on the funding and like what is going on when, but I guess what I heard was that the majority of people aren't even using Ross Cole because the court's in pretty bad shape for tennis as well. And ultimately, I know it seems like a lot of the concern wasn't so much the amount of courts right now, it's just amount of usable courts. So if you give them two courts, it's like way better than where we're at today. So I guess if we focused on maybe just keeping the two courts and keep them two courts as tennis courts, and then have an option later where even possible, if the sport of pickleball continues to blow up like it does, the ability to add it later doesn't seem like it's that far off, seeing that it's to grade already and you're just talking about possibly asphalt or maybe even doing like a packed DG surface or something for parking in that for that alternate location. But just a couple ideas.
There is a way to stripe a tennis court that with pickleball lines that doesn't interfere as much as the ones that we've done so far. It's called ghost lining, and you use a paint for the pickleball lines that is not a high contrast paint, so it doesn't cause this as much problem. I mean, it's still not ideal for the tennis community, but I believe the USTA has actually approved funding some courts that are dual striped in that manner. So it's not impossible. With a situation like that, you would use portable nets so the players for pickleball. In other words, you'd keep the tennis net permanent, and the portable nets would be used for the pickleball. But that brings up the idea that, you know, people have to have their own net to come out and play pickleball.
Mr. Long?
So for the future, for this future meeting, could we just make a note of maybe consider two tennis courts for Ross Gold, but then look at Mills Park and maybe compromise with the tennis group at the Mills Park to possibly, or that's just... Ultimately, it wouldn't be up to me, but that's just a suggestion. But to add to the discussion to maybe convert those over to.
And I think it's really valid as we're looking at this. And I know what Supervisor Bagwell said earlier, and I wholeheartedly agree. We're looking at, like, for our playground safety program, we're looking at the entire city and looking at that holistically. Where do we have playgrounds so neighborhoods have access to it? Might not right be in their backyard, but it's such an expensive and a high liability to the city. We want to reduce our playgrounds, but the ones that we have, we want to make sure meet all the safety standards, right? So when we look at tennis and pickleball, and I think this is a great future agenda item, but tennis and pickleball do still have great participation. Tennis has gone down with golf, but it's still really significant and important to people. So I think it's important, and I think we're partnering with the CTA, maybe like at Centennial and at Mills, and we can bring in tournaments if we had really good facilities. But to have combined uses, it's difficult in a tournament base. So in my mind, and I'm not sold on this, but we've talked to a lot of folks, is really focusing that tennis use at Centennial. Maybe there is a pickleball option where we have one court with four so we can accommodate both, and then vice versa at Mills where we have a pickleball complex and then we still have a tennis court available for people. So we are accommodating it, but if we had a big tournament, you could really focus that use. And those two facilities have the parking available, and, you know, we could be able to do that. But then conversely, in the neighborhood parks, I'd really like to try to, if we could, accommodate both uses, because you have those drop-in users, if we can. So that solves the problem, except for the funding piece, and then we could make that happen. But conceptually, that's sort of what I'm thinking on how do we approach that, because we can't make everybody happy everywhere. That neighborhood tennis concept of the 80s is hard to sustain because they're the same courts that were put in the 80s.
Commissioner Whitfield, and then I'd like to open it up for public comment.
Okay, thank you. One quick comment about pickleball at Centennial. One of the other aspects of pickleball is that it's much more sensitive to wind than tennis. The balls are basically wiffle balls, and the wind really moves the ball around. So my gut feeling about Centennial is that it's going to be a windier environment potentially than, say, Mills Park. So it would not be ideal from a wind standpoint for to locate a lot of pickleball at Centennial. Thank you.
We talked about this earlier. The NRPA has standards for populations and so forth. How have we looked at that as far as how many tennis courts, usable tennis courts or not usable tennis court? We have that infrastructure. Are we behind in that? Are we right where we're supposed to be as far as tennis courts? And correspondingly, now that pickleball is on the ticks, you know, ticking up, is there a survey for that and our population base?
So that's a great question. I can look at that again, but the last time I reviewed their metrics, they didn't do that anymore where they had so many tennis courts per population, so many pickleball, okay. Because areas are so diverse and people are having to be creative to provide these multi-use complexes. That's not really realistic anymore.
Okay.
But I can check that again just to make sure.
Ooh,
and
no,
for that
fine.
Next agenda item, I think it's a good question.
Just curious, so because I know we used that in the past. Thank you.
So, I guess my concern really is, while I understand what you were trying to say about a neighborhood park and saying, okay, so I'll give you one tennis court and one pickleball because it's really not a regional park and therefore it's not going to be a tournament park. But I still, for me, want to look at the overall expenses that we have and how do I accommodate as much of the needs of the community as we can. And I just really think that should be another tennis court. I just think we're going to have to start making some hard decisions about where are we putting what, because I want the greatest good, and I really think I need, you know, 12 pickleball to accommodate what we want to do for outdoor pickleball. And so he may only get Mills Park, and that just may have to be, because I think I heard someone else comment, you know, there's only the pot of money that we have, and I think we need to be realistic in our master planning so that when I'm putting it out to the public, it's also something I'm going to try and support then when I sit in the other side, which is the money half, and put it to it. So I look at this as saying, okay, we have $57,300 in residential construction tax. I really don't have any usable tennis courts in the community right now. I'm just thinking out loud here as a plan, you could come and ask for some additional residential construction tax and get these two tennis courts done. So I heard someone say, we just want something done. And so I kind of going to have to go with that. My own self thinking we might be able to get two tennis courts and use the residential construction tax, and we will take Diane's $10,000 from her fund that she offered up, and since that's there, I just think we have a viable option to accomplish the two tennis courts and then use your lovely money too at the Mills Park. Anyway,
That's just my two cents, that we could actually accomplish it. And I'm really into delivering something. We could then have the meeting on the future agenda item as to what the right surface is. I think I heard Mr. Kyle or whatever talk about that, but
I think we can even meet with them separately and have some operational discussions.
Yeah, and do that. Yeah. So that, as far as my preference is, we change this to a tennis court. And because I just think that I also don't want all the other neighborhood parks to start getting the idea, because we're already going to be taking away playgrounds. And so I just think we have the big picture to look at. So I think the pickleball should become a tennis court. But.
All right, CK, would you like to make a public comment?
Chairman Leanne, yeah, you can put it on me. I think fishing really should be, I mean, forget all this. You guys are just like beating each other up with balls and stuff like that. Stick a fish in it. No. I had to, like, change gears just a little bit. And I actually do have a very interesting question. I think Leanne may be the only one that's here that was around, maybe you were, Lori, when we were looking at Ross Gold as being a fishing pond. And it was not viable. It was deemed that it wasn't viable because, first of all, it's chlorinated water, which doesn't work well with freshwater fish. The temperature is ridiculously high. And then it comes to my question, which is drainage. And I guess this one is for Director Budge. Does Ross Gold have any drainage? Was any put in? Was there any idea that there was going to be drainage put in, or is it still evaporation?
For the pond water?
Yes, ma'am.
No, there isn't any drainage.
Okay.
So if we do the improvement, we would incorporate that.
Okay.
That's an issue.
That is a large issue. Thank you, mm-hmm. By the way.
We have significant water loss. It's not just evaporation. I think it's, you know.
So it is it's the clay lining you're losing it through the bottom of it, not necessarily all through evaporation, but it is basically and probably mostly evaporation, which leaves total dissolved solids into that water, which is why it's called the poop pond or whatever you want to call it, the duck pond. I guess there's a few ducks there, mostly geese. But that was my question, and thank you for taking your time on that. It's an issue. It has been an issue. And, I mean, I could get into Ross Gold Pond as far as a fishery. That was what was looked at prior to where it resides now at Fuji, which was a gift from God. So if there's any way that I could, you know, bring in some more light on that, that's to be taken offline, and we can discuss that at one's convenience. But I was just wondering what you wanted to do with that water, because that's a significant problem. Thank you.
Commissioner Whitfield?
Mr. Bailey, thank you. I just had a quick question to clarify. I want to make sure I understood what your the totality of your point. I think you're supporting the change that's recommended in this master plan to the pond. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, CK Bailey. Once again, this is the first I've read about some changes that were going to be made to Ross Gold. I didn't realize it was this significant. So this is the first document that I've seen so far myself that really puts down like what Vern Caron has put into paper here and what the city is looking to do. So no, I can't say that I have any prior knowledge or that I'm finite with anything. And this is the first time looking at it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope that answered it.
Any other questions or comments from the commissioners? Any other public comment? All right. commission's pleasure on this? Do we want to move to approve it? Do we want further discussion? What's everybody's pleasure? Laura, you want to take the lead?
Well, we can kind of talk about this in two different ways. One, if she gets the master plan completed and sent to the Board of Supervisors to get it adopted, it's easier for her when she wants to put a budget to it. Without the master plan, I can tell you already that the Board of Supervisors has become very passionate about not approving dollars. Is that a nice way to say that? Without the master plan, like Fuji Park, we're just not going to do it anymore.
Roadmap of how the money's going to be spent.
Well, we just, again, we want thoughtful expenditures, and we want to know that we're not putting something in and going to turn around and say, oh, that wasn't the right place to put it and tear it up. You know, that give me a plan, and then we can work to solve that plan. So do I think this has to go today if you really think it needs more? I think they've done a super job. I think they did everything they should do. They went out and got public comment. They went and did all that they can do. And I didn't hear anything tonight that I thought would stop us. The real discussion is, do we want two tennis courts or a pickleball? And then we could move on. And then maybe she can get it past the Board of Supervisors and start getting grants and really making this, to me, I really championed the universal playground and working on the ADA one, and I'd like to be able to continue to concentrate on a park to finish, you know, and say, okay, the next step is let's put the residential construction tax, let's see if there's some more money in that fund, which I know there is, and see if I can't take care of two tennis courts and have movement on our parks instead of, oh my gosh, it's a plan we can't ever achieve or we can't do anything where I think we can. So it's just a question for the chair. Just a thought.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we were to move to accept this with the change of making the pickleball a tennis court, would that be acceptable to move this forward tonight? I so move.
Is there a second?
I'll second. One clarification, I just want to be sure, but I talked to Vern about that, but having the path would be the ADA, like paved path, and then on the side would be like a soft surface, which I believe that's what he's indicated is the DG surface. If you could just, we could just include that to be sure that is indeed part of the plan.
Yeah, we can try to do that. Depending on the grade in every area, we might have some areas that might not quite meet those guidelines, but like where possible.
Yeah.
So we have a motion.
Madam Chair, could I get the motion one more time?
Yes,
I didn't realize
say,
it was a motion.
All right. Commissioner Whitfield, would you like to remake your motion?
I'll make another try at it. I move that we accept the Roscoe Master Plan with the change being the proposed pickleball courts become another tennis court. So we have two tennis courts.
And DG.
Where possible.
Soft DG, where possible.
Where possible.
All right. Now, who made the second?
I made the second.
All right. So Commissioner Long made the second. All right. Any discussion? Any comment? All those in favor?
Aye.
All right. The motion carries. Jennifer, do you have enough to go forward?
We do. Thank you so much. And I'll let you know when we get that scheduled at the Board of Supervisors.
Excellent.
So we'll revise that drawing and then bring that back.
All right. So let's move on to agenda item 3E, discussion and possible action regarding a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors regarding the proposed Carson City rifle and pistol range fee schedule. Jennifer, is this you or?
This is. We have a tag team effort.
Okay.
So I'm here with Chris Carver. He's the president of the Carson Rifle and Pistol Club, and they're our nonprofit partner in operating and helping us manage the Carson City Rifle and Pistol Range. And so we thought we'd tag team on this presentation a little bit. So okay. We're going to talk tonight about the draft fee schedule. So as I mentioned, the facility is owned by Carson City. We have a written agreement with a private nonprofit organization, which is the Carson Rifle and Pistol Club. They've been a great partner. They're providing range safety officers for us. They also do all of the reservations for the facility, and they manage a website that helps do that. They also help with outreach and education and provide a lot of services to the city. So we're really lucky to have them working with us. There was a range task force developed, as you know, and it was a temporary advisory board appointed by the Board of Supervisors. They recently had probably their last meeting for a while, unless we need to revisit anything, but they were created to help provide assistance to the staff and the city and look at operations and future development, funding, and kind of work through some of the challenges that we've had on site. They had a draft fee schedule that's in your packet, and that's what the range task force is recommending to you for approval and to go to the Board of Supervisors. But we're here tonight to talk about that fee schedule and answer your questions and work through that kind of moving forward, because ultimately the Board of Supervisors has to approve that plan. We've had a lot of questions from some of you, and I really appreciate it, about what are the existing fee policies and guidelines that we sort of need to look at. And they're very old and dated. I want to point that out. So there was a resolution. You have a couple copies up there. We emailed it out today that was approved in 2009. So it's resolution 2009 R6. It talks about cost recovery guidelines. It talks about nonprofit rates and also about non-resident options. And then I brought Danner up here, too, so he can help if you have questions on how we have other fees established, how our system works, and anything like that. We kind of have a team approach with us tonight. We also have in the Parks and Recreation Master Plan, which was also in the early 2000s approved, and it provides direction on level of service standards. So that does impact how our fees are established as well. So we have a couple guiding documents. And then we also have in your packet a market analysis that we did, a few other rifle ranges and facilities and what they charge, looking at Douglas County, Washoe County, Ben Avery, and a few other facilities. So you can see what other agencies are charging for this type of service.
Good evening. My name is Chris Carter. I'm the president of the Rifle and Pistol Club. And as Jennifer said, we have a partnership with the city, and we really appreciate the efforts of Park and Rec over the last 6-7 months to get the range back operational. As you may know, there's some emotion tied to operation of the range. So what I wanted to do tonight was to introduce some data points that we collected, our range safety officers collected over the month of July for the recreational shooters that shoot on Sunday when the range is open to the public. We typically see 50 to 100 shooters on a Sunday. Of these, approximately 74% of the shooters don't have appropriate target stands and paper targets to shoot at. They typically want to shoot at things that are on the ground, cardboard boxes, cans and bottles, folded cardboard or props that they get from other commercial activities, or these rubber balls that are capable of taking around. That typically means that they want to shoot very close to where they're standing. We still have a significant problem with trigger trash. 10% is cans, bottles. We've had some appliances, ceramic tiles for flooring and that kind of thing. We have a problem with 10 to 15% of our shooters showing up with no hearing protection. And I'm not talking about earphones, I'm talking about earplugs, just the disposable 15 cents a pair that you can get at a home supply store. 20 to 40% of our shooters are novice shooters. They come unprepared. They typically have a firearm and a box of ammo or two, and that's it. No instruction, no safety equipment, and some of them come directly from point of purchase out to the range on a Sunday. And as I'll talk to you in the next slide, this is a problem because there's no retail outlet that's specifically firearms-oriented open on a Sunday afternoon for our shooters to get the materials that they need. They can go to Cal Ranch or one of the other stores that are open on a Sunday, or Sportsman, to get some of the stuff that they need. But I wanted to talk about who it is that are going to be paying your user fees and why it's important to understand what your demographic is. The majority of our users at the range are not from Carson City. They're from neighboring counties. 20-30% of these are out-of-state residents come across the border to shoot at our facility because of the restrictions in California. Most of our shooters don't check the websites, and you've heard before this evening about outreach. That's a major problem for us because we have an extensive list of rules, us in the city, and there's some safety requirements that are non-negotiable when it comes to using firearms. Less than half of our shooters plan a trip to the range, that they actually think this out before they show up at the range. There's an expectation that they're going to have supplies or their supply needs met at the range, and that includes targets, not ammunition, but basic safety supplies, including eye protection and hearing protection. Some of the weapons that we see out there are lacking in basic maintenance, and there's no source for lubrication, clean rods and that kind of stuff out on the range. And then we have the standing problem of hydration. If you don't bring it with you, you're just not going to be there on the range. And Parks have been very forthcoming in helping us meet, all of us, meet the requirement that takes place out on the range. And then this is a design issue. Almost all of our pistol shooters want to shoot at less than 10 to 15 to 25 yards. And what that means is that the deflection angle on the floor of the range is going to be significantly greater than it is at distance on the rifle range or even on the pistol range of 52 yards. What we found in our experience, these are professional instructors and range safety officers, so got a little different attitude when we're dealing with folks. And one of the things that we found is that most people do want to comply with the city requirements. They definitely want to comply with the safety requirements, but they don't have a means to do so, especially at the range. So we have partnered with Parks to provide clays for them to shoot out on the backstops. Most of our RSOs bring safety equipment with them. We hand it out. I hand out target stands and targets for people to use when they come up short. And the whole purpose of that is to promote safe shooting behaviors as opposed to just letting things run out. Next slide. Thank you. And to this effort, we provided 430 hours of professional range safety officer volunteer hours to help make the range work. We also have other hours that are donated to the city to help maintain the facility. We have 22 RSOs in the program, and our observations are exactly what I said, that compliance and cooperation are up. The city's provided, in this case, clays and other safety equipment out there to make the range, fire extinguishers, hygiene items that make shooting safer. But we've got a ways to go. Basic range etiquette is improving, and the safety is improving, and that's the key to solving the problem of why bullets left the range, and the perception that the range may be unsafe, either in design or behavior. So that's all I had for you tonight. I just wanted you to kind of understand some data points that we've collected over the last month so as you make this decision, you're well informed.
Whitfield.
Thank you. Thanks for the presentation. I appreciate it. My question is specific to the proposed fee schedule, and I looked at the most recently available minutes from the task force, the range task force. For the annual passes, we have the adults, youth, senior, family, and then there's a veterans with 50% or greater disability rating, and I saw in the minutes that that's similar to what we do at the pool. I was just wondering if we could do, like, adults have the one cost, youth, seniors, military and veterans could have the half price, and then veterans with the disability rating could still be free. That way we can still show support for military and non-disabled veterans in some way. Just throwing that out there.
Commissioner Bagwell.
I think I can take on most of that because we probably, I don't remember how many hours we spent on the
fees
twice because we had two meetings about it. And one of the most important components we were trying to do is to be consistent in what we do in our other parks at the MAC and our other locations. And so
what we felt strongly about is that we were going to do the same thing. Now, Jennifer gave us the resolution, and so I would personally feel that I don't want to make something different here than we do in all of our other fee schedules at the swimming pool. So it would be, for me, more, and we've talked about this actually, that we need to bring all of our fee schedules forward for discussion and review. So I don't have an issue with the recommendation, but I don't feel it's appropriate to implement it here until I would say we do it everywhere. You know, that we're going to do all our military or veterans at this.
I make a motion we do it everywhere.
But I got what you, you know, again, I just want to say that we were trying desperately here to be consistent so that park staffs and policies match, that we didn't treat the people at the gun range differently than we treated the people at the MAC
or
the swimming pool. And so I do think your point of a is a larger issue of discussion that I think we certainly could take up. But we did discuss that at the range meeting, and that's why we didn't. We just wanted to stay consistent with what we did everywhere else. But, again, not adverse to your overall point.
Commissioner Whitfield.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the presentation. I have two questions. One is, are the RSOs volunteers?
Chris Carter from the Rifle Pistol Club. Yes, they are, but they are vetted. So they come with National Rifle Association certification, then they're trained by us, and they're approved by the club before they go out. But yes, they are volunteers.
Okay, thanks for that. Well, thanks for their service, too. That's quite
very glad to do
that. That's a lot of hours put in for volunteers.
We do have range safety officers provided by the city during the week, and that's our park rangers. We've also put them through the National Rifle Association training, and then they've been trained by the club as well on site. So we have sort of a team effort, but the majority of the range safety officers are provided by the club right now.
Okay, very good. Second question is there, I'm a very novice shooter, but I'm interested. Is there any formal training or education available at the range, or are there any plans to do something like that could be publicized and maybe get people more involved?
There isn't any formal training right now, but it's something that Chris and I have talked about, and we really want to develop, I think even beyond the existing agreement, is an education program, a really robust one for the city, for all people that go here. Maybe we have an online component on the website where you could get oriented to our range and get some basic instruction, maybe some classes. I've offered our classroom space if we ever want to have anything available, and also partnering with the Nevada Department of Wildlife. They have a great hunter education program, and that's something that we definitely want to do, because the more informed people are, the better shooting behavior they're going to have on site, and then the facility is going to be safer.
Thank you, Director Budge. Just a quick comment. I took a CCW class a couple of years ago, and I have to say that I passed the class and I got the permit, but I don't feel like I was really trained. And I think a lot of people would appreciate a more complete set of training, firearm training. So I hope you can look at that.
So I know that when the Ladies Gun Club was really the push to get the restroom facilities out there, and one of the other components and working with wildlife that we were interested in was building a classroom facility, because I think you're absolutely right that, I don't know, again, a lovely master plan for that facility could certainly include that, because there's just no place to have a good educational training classes and things like that, but that's certainly a laudable goal for that facility too, because it's easier to do your classroom instruction and then go and teach the hunter safety classes and things like that. I don't want to remember when I was 12, but, you know, that's the type of stuff that you do. You get instruction and then you practice it because it's better. But that's certainly a long-term goal to get grants and activities, and I think that the club is after the right answer there to add education as time goes on. And I will say just too that some might not know here, but the city added a position to actually be at the range to try and help with the safety and the education, like you said, all the time about, nope, this isn't the proper procedure and do this. And so, but yes.
A question from Commissioner Meyer, then Commissioner Long, and then I have a question.
I had two questions. The first question was, after reading the fee resolution of 2009 and being familiar with that since I was working for the Recreation Department at that time, what do you have an explanation for the out-of-state opposed to just a simple non-resident?
So that was a really robust conversation and a pretty passionate one. I will say the majority of people wanted a benefit to being a resident of Carson City, and it got into a larger conversation about how the funds are allocated through the Department of Wildlife, and it's more looking at like hunter, like when you go to get your hunting license, there are state licenses, and how the funding is allocated. The majority of the funding that we get from the Department of Wildlife is actually federal funding. So it's ammunition sales. So it's Pittman Robertson money. So it's ammunition sales. It's federal pass-through state grants. So to me, the state non-state issue as far as funding isn't really valid because that's not how we're getting our funding. But we are competing for grant funds throughout the state for improvements of the range. So I think that's sort of how the state issue really happened. We know we have a lot of people coming in from California and Lake Tahoe and all over coming into the range, and a lot of outside users. So there was a lot of passionate discussion about having a resident or a non-resident concept, and they sort of all agreed upon in the end that it would be a state non-state. I do just want to point out we don't have state non-state anywhere else throughout our park system. So having, from a staff perspective, having to manage a state, non-state in some areas and a city, non-city in some areas, it does create a logistical challenge for us. It's not one we couldn't overcome, but I do want to just point that out.
May I comment on that, though? Just to be clear on what happened at the range meeting, though, I want to be clearer on the discussion. So, first of all, this is going to, is the only park in which a person will have an envelope and everything is on the trust basis, right? So they fill out their envelope, put their money in it, and put it in the Iron Ranger. So the other issue became enforcement. And so it's easy for me to look at a license plate and see he has his envelope there, and the license plate is Nevada or non-Nevada. So it isn't going to be the staff in an office or a swimming pool walk up. It doesn't work quite the same other than the pass. The issue was, though, the staff person can easily look at the fee, take his tag, and say, yep, he's got a Nevada license plate. So that was part of the discussion that took place, is the actual enforcement component. It's an event versus walking up and saying, oh, gosh, now I got to figure out if that plate is a Carson City plate or is he a Mound House or is he. So that was the other thing. And I think that probably was our largest discussion, if I recall, time-wise, on the guy lives in Mound House right there, and so we're going to charge him $10 to drive less distance. I remember that specific comment. Less distance than the guy that lives in Silver Oak and has to get to the range. And so it just, that was the discussion. Oh. Handily,
Jennifer,
the discussion.
Did you want to make-
So I think it's a really good point to talk about how these fees would be implemented when it happens. Now, I think the intent is when we have improvements, then we'll implement the fee structure. So it's not something that's going to be implemented tomorrow. Let's say the Board of Supervisors approves it. So I want to make sure that we're all on the same page with that. These are fees in the future once we have improvements and the facilities open more often. So the drop in fees, it's envisioned just like a state park facility where you'd have an envelope, you put in your $5, and then you put it in the they call them Iron Rangers, those metal containers. And then we would have staff emptying those every day and out and about on a regular basis. All the other fees would be booked online. So through our existing system, most likely through our active net system. So just to be clear about the logistics of that piece.
So to comment on that, when you read through this document, in my opinion, those fees are outlined and the structure to build those fees are outlined. For an example, not selling passes to outer residents, to have those outer residents come and pay the drop-in fee every time. That is outlined in 2009. The 25% for a non-resident is also outlined in this document that says if we're going to charge our residents $5, we're going to charge a non-resident 25% more, which would be $750. So those things are outlined in here, and I appreciate that somebody in Lyon County is closer to the gun range than somebody that lives in Silver Oak, but I also appreciate that they don't go to City Hall and pay taxes every quarter. So, and that is our facility. We can see it as a regional facility, and I think it's awesome that Carson City has facilities that everybody comes to, like the tennis courts and the aquatic facility. Now, it shows what a great facilities we have and what we give our community. But that doesn't mean we should be giving it away to people that aren't paying taxes for the infrastructure that build those facilities, that manage those facilities, and that have staff on board that are writing grants for those facilities. So with that, I would recommend that we would go back and use this document to look at these fees. And it sounds to me like we have time to do that, Jennifer. So that's just my two cents. And I was at the range task force meeting and I watched the whole thing.
All right, Commissioner Long, did you?
Yeah, I appreciate the education aspect of it because I feel like people kind of do. I myself don't shoot, but I feel like people kind of go for it sometimes. And I don't see, I kind of actually assumed that people going to the range might be a little bit more orderly. So I appreciate you improving that. I do spend a lot of time out in the open space, and I see a lot of debris and that kind of thing from shooting. And I think it tends to be people take things out there to shoot them, shoot it up, and leave it there. And I guess you call that maybe trigger trash. So one, I guess, concern I have is by starting to charge, are more people going to be going out and not going to? And so I'm sure those discussions have happened, and what has come of that as far as obviously the education aspect of it, but what other efforts are being done to help educate people to, hey, if you do go out in the open land or wherever, to pick up after yourself and leave it like you found it?
So I'm going to give you a long response, but I want to make it clear that the Board of Supervisors has approved a full-time position that we're currently recruiting for that will be full-time, fully benefited to work at this facility. So for the first time, we'll have staff there other than maintenance a couple days a week. Also, the board has approved capital improvements, money for future capital improvements, $250,000 that we'll be utilizing for improvements and hopefully as a match for future grants to really rehabilitate the facility and get it up to standards. So with that investment, and then the board approved an interim plan as well and already had said that any future fees that would be charged at the facility would go back into the operation, maintenance, and improvement of this facility. So I think to get back to your answer, part of it is educating the public on these fees, but don't worry, every dollar that you put in is going back into this facility, so it can be something they can be proud of. So hopefully that's a good incentive for people. I think the fees, you know, you have a market analysis and what other people are charging. A lot of people, some people charge less. Like if you go to Douglas County, it's $2 a vehicle. If you go to Washoe County, it's significantly higher if you're dropping in. So that's why we provided that for you as well. So I think if our fees are fair and reasonable, I think people will pay and people will use the facility. If they want to go out in the desert, they're going to do that anyway. But, and some people are doing that. They don't want to come here for whatever reason. And a lot of people are going to do that. And hopefully they can be sound and we can educate people on how to safely do that as well. And I know the BLM and the Forest Service have a lot of education materials and we can help educate the public on that piece. But if we can keep the money where it's at, it's really, I think, a testament to what the Board of Supervisors' commitment to the facility is, because every other dollar that we earn, except for the cemetery, goes into the general fund. And we are heavily subsidized by the general fund as well, but it's not always being reinvested into that facility where it was earned. So I think educating the public on that would hopefully reduce it. And as long as the fees are affordable, I don't see it really contributing to that additional issue out in the desert. Does that help? I'm not sure I quite. Okay.
So the other thing is going to be, so out of the roughly 100-ish people that have, it sounds like the analysis was mainly done on Sundays, but how many of those are returned? Do you have an idea how many returning shooters? Yeah, is it the 50 to 100?
So we have what we euphemistically refer to as the frequent flyers of people that come back every week. Typically, if they have a good experience, they'll come back. If they have a bad experience or their needs aren't met, then they probably won't. Because it's not Carson City that's predominantly using the facility, the demographic pool is significantly larger, especially from Washoe County. So we see 10 to 15% roughly when I work the range, and I work primarily evening shift, but it's not consistent. And depending on how the weather is, if it's hot, less people. If it's nice, if it's windy, it all changes. So these statistics are a snapshot. They're not necessarily extremely accurate, because it is only on Sunday when we're having recreational shooters, and it only involves the RSOs that have collected the statistics, and we extrapolated from there. So I'm pretty confident in the numbers, and we do know that the shooters that come out repeatedly get better. They tend to, well, I need to go fix that target solution, and come out with a stand, or they bring the proper ammunition and they have the appropriate safety gear. But it's like any other sport. If they come out and participate once, then the next time they come back, they're coming out better prepared.
I have a question. Currently, the facility is only open on Sundays, right? Do we have any plans to open it other days to expand the hours of operation, or what's happening that way?
So for right now, the public use is on Sundays from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. We also have evening opportunities Tuesday through Friday from 5:45 to 8 p.m. So I do have some statistics. We were operating just on Wednesday and Thursday nights for a while. We had 278 shooters total for 19 days. So we have anywhere from 3 attending up to 26 in a night, and even to just come for a couple hours. So that's growing. The number keeps going up as we've had other opportunities. So now our range safety officers are going to be there, our park rangers, you know, Tuesday through Fridays. So we'll continue to take numbers and gather data. We didn't have any really hard population and participation numbers from the facility. A lot of them were just estimates. We knew how many tournaments and how many shooters, but the general drop in public use were a lot of just guesstimates. So we're going to continue to get this data so that way we can report it back to you, and hopefully that can help drive other decisions as we move forward. But yes, the goal is to increase the public use. Yep.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This seems trivial compared to the larger issues here, but I mean, maybe you're already doing this, but since these fees, or proposed fees, are going to go back into the facility, is there been consideration to either signage or maybe on the envelope that goes in the Iron Ranger, some statement to the effect so that people know that their fees are going back into the facility?
That's a great suggestion, and we can make sure that when we prepare those envelopes, we have the same messaging on the website and on that, and any signage or advertising that we do. That's a great, great suggestion. Thank you.
Any other commissioner comments or questions? Then CK, it's your turn.
Thank you, Commissioner Keever, Chairman, Chairlady, and commissioners. I really like Commissioner Long's take on a lot of these things. He answered and asked a lot of questions that I would be interested in. You, sir, are you a head of a club, of an organization, or you're representing an organization?
I am. I'm president of the Carson Rifle and Pistol Club.
Okay, fantastic. And you folks use NRA?
We do.
Okay. We're doing really well. By the way, I'm a lifer, NRA, as is my father. And I guess safety above all. The range for me used to be a really neat place where I could go and I could set up my targets. I could set up bottles. I could bring my kids, my grandkids, and we could just shoot the heck out of it, have a blast, clean up our stuff. There was always a garbage can. We never just left stuff. Chances were I picked up as much brass as I could because I'm cheap and I enjoy reloading. Okay, so all of a sudden it became tight. It became not convenient to go there. I would rather go out into the desert and try my luck there, find a safety background as safety as I could with as little cheatgrass as that's available, go out with my fire extinguishers and my shovel just as I was going out camping, and go shooting. Because I'm just a recreational shooter. That's all I am. I don't have a hunting license. I don't think I've had a Nevada hunting license. I'm a fisherman, but I like to shoot. So, a club should be helping to provide education, in my opinion. Okay? NDAO is a huge resource. The National Rifle Association, whatever you think about it, is a fathomless resource. Do I agree with everything they do? No. Do I belong? Yes. Will I? Till I die. They have tons of stuff available for the asking. Most of it's online. Most of it doesn't care if you're a member. The place that the Carson City Range would intrigue me and that interests me is for those who need to sight in a rifle for hunting. Okay? That's what, above all, as far as target shooting, like critical accuracy target shooting, somebody needs to sight in a rifle to go hunting, man, that should be available at Carson City Range. That's worth asking money for, is to have something like that. Okay? If there is a place where I can, at the Carson Range, and I'm not even sure anymore because now it's Sundays only and like that, well, I won't even go there Sundays. I won't go there Sundays. I'm going out shooting during the week when there's not masses of people. So I don't know if I'm making sense to you. That's just me. I think there's probably a lot of me's out there. Anyway, I don't know if that was helpful or not. It's really a pleasure to make your acquaintance. I was one of the guys that said like this to get the NDAO restroom because I didn't want to see ladies having to go out into the field with the snakes. Okay? I know they're tough. It's no put down to the ladies. It's just that they're ladies and shouldn't have to be put through that. And that it would also be something that would attract the female audience. Some of the finest shooters in America are female. Our Olympic teams are female. There's always top in the world. Gold medalists, females. Thank you.
Thank you, CK. We appreciate it. Any other comments or thoughts? What's the commission's pleasure on this? Do we want to make a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors? Commissioner Cartwright?
I move to recommend to the Board of Supervisors approval of the Carson City Rifle and Pistol Range fee schedule as presented.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
I'm trying not to, only because I did it.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner Long. Any discussion? All right, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. The motion carries. Thank you so much. You're abstaining? You're voting no?
He wants it.
Okay.
He can count me out of county.
Okay. Right.
Well, I want it to be the way the resolution is put forth.
Okay.
As of 2009.
Just to confirm, Madam Chair, it's 6-1?
Yes.
Thank you.
Or do you have another go forward? 5-1, I'm sorry. 5-1, huh? Sorry. 5-1. Oh, we forgot we were missing one.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Joe's here in spirit.
See, we're actually awake.
Thank you.
Okay, Jennifer, do you have enough to go forward with
yes,
this?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay. All right, let's move on to item 3F, discussion and possible action regarding a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors regarding proposed amendments to the Park and Recreation Commission bylaws.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jennifer Budge, Parks and Recreation Director. I'll try to keep this quick because I know you guys are getting tired, I'm sure. In your packet, you have a copy of the existing bylaws with a couple proposed changes that Deputy District Attorney Ben Johnson and I worked on. As you recall, we had a meeting a few months ago. We didn't have a quorum, and it basically was due to the language in the bylaws not being consistent with the state statutes and Carson City Municipal Code. So it's kind of a cleanup, if you will, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have on the proposed changes or if there's additional changes you would like to see, and Ben can help guide us through this if we need any help.
I take a quick look at it, and I'm impressed with what you did. A lot of these changes make a lot of sense, so I'm happy with them, but if there's any comments or questions from the commissioner, Commissioner Cartwright, Commissioner Whitfield?
Just a quick comment. The consequence of the lack of quorum at the last meeting prohibited me from making a very good pickleball presentation. So
so we got you tonight?
So we got me tonight.
All right, then.
Any other comments or questions from the commission? All right, any public comment on this? Okay, Commissioner Bagwell.
Since we have the bylaws, one of the things that we do, it's at the first regular meeting of the calendar year, the commission will elect a chair and vice chair. Do we want to keep it that it's every year we elect a chair and vice chair?
I thought it was sure that we had to do it.
I know, but it's because it's in our bylaws. So my question to all of you is, do you want to do two-year appointments? Is it, I just question, so first and foremost, how long is a term of a park and rec commissioner?
4 years.
4 years, and do you want to change, we just keep reelecting her, but that's my point, is do we want to make them two? And Brett, you served as a chair even before, and since they're open, it's just a discussion item, do we don't have to do it every year. We could have chairs serve two-year terms. What's your guys' thoughts on that? Because I often have found, especially since the way we're now meeting every other, I just bring that up for a point of discussion since we're not meeting every month. Should we go to two-year terms for the chair?
Well, the benefit of a two-year term for a chair and vice chair is you're learning the ropes the first year. The second year, you're comfortable, so you would be able to hit your stride and be more efficient, I would say.
Bring that up.
Well, any thoughts or comments on that point?
What? You?
I don't feel strongly one way or the other, but the other aspect is that if somebody wants to fulfill like a four-year term and two individuals are elected, there's no chance of them being able to be chair.
That's a fair point.
What do you mean?
Well, say somebody's elected for 4 years, and for two of those years they're chair. Then that doesn't give anybody else on the board an opportunity to serve as either chair or vice chair.
As many. I was saying, yes, you can. It's two and two. Do we have to do annual?
Madam Chair, Deputy District Attorney Ben Johnson, for the record. yes, according to NRS 244.3079, it does require annual elections for the reorganization of the board.
Then why is it in the bylaws? Oh, sorry. If it's a statute, you don't need it in the bylaw. That's okay. I'm just sorry. That's fine.
Thanks for that.
It's already a statutory requirement? Yeah. Okay.
Thanks for pointing that out. I appreciated it.
And you could keep it in the bylaws just so that you don't always have to go back and refer to the statute just for, you know, clarity and ease of access.
that was quick.
Yeah, but we never bring it up again.
Is it on?
It's on now.
Uh-oh.
That's on.
Is his... No, we're having some mic problems at 3 hours.
You can't see it live. I'm opening
up. Okay. All right. So are there any other comments or concerns about the bylaws from the commission? CK, do you have any comments you'd like to make? No other comments from the public? Okay. Done.
We even lost the press.
We did. All right. So what is the commission's pleasure on this?
I move to make a motion to modify the bylaws as stated and include the NRS statement on the end of the election annually.
Appointment. Okay.
Second.
Is there a second?
Second.
Commissioner Whitfield? All right. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
All right. This time it is unanimous. And it's 6-0. Yeah, 1, 2, 3. Yes.
You actually could count at this hour.
All right. Jennifer, you're up to bat now with your director's report.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple quick updates. I just wanted to point out that Nick Wentworth was the employee of the quarter for Carson City, and he received a check and got acknowledgement at a Board of Supervisors meeting. His family was here. It was great. He's one of our park maintenance coordinators. He oversees the cemetery. He's an irrigation expert. He's been just wonderful, and he's one of our best employees. So I just wanted to acknowledge him publicly and thank him and let you know that the Board of Supervisors acknowledged him. And then we did receive $20,000 from the Robert Z. Hawkins Foundation. Eric Klug wrote his first grant, and he did a great job, and we were very successful. We took them on a tour of the theater. They were so excited about our community theater here. I think it's probably a good partnership that we'll have on an annual basis, and we're so appreciative of their support. But I just want to clarify that the city applied for the grant, and the city received the grant. There was some confusion about the gala, because all the proceeds from the gala is currently being held by the Foundation for Carson City Parks. So there's some funding with the city and some funding with the foundation that we're combined together for a lot of improvements for the lobby and the theater. So I just want to point that out, but thank the Hawkins Foundation and to thank Eric for all his hard work on that grant. And then our first ever annual report. So this was our first shot at it, and I wanted to just really see what you thought as far as format and the data that we're collecting, and just to provide sort of a snapshot of what our department does. There's a lot of things that we do that are not in here, but I wanted to thank Dan. Dan put this together with Kristen Simons, our AmeriCorps Vista, that only has one more week left with us, but they've worked really hard to give you some great statistics and help educate you on all the things that we do, how many volunteer hours we have, and all the things that we've been busy doing. And so my hope is on an annual basis in July, we have Parks and Recreation Month at the board, and my hope is to start next year and always do an annual report for the Board of Supervisors on the department. But I wanted to bring this to you and see what you thought about format and the data that we're collecting and make sure that that's just get your feedback on what's provided in front of you. And I think this will be a great tool when we meet with foundations to show all that we accomplish and all that we do and help kind of tell our story to the public and to potential donors and participants as we move forward.
This is great. I like the format. It's easy to read. The information is accessible. You're not thumbing through a 30-page report trying to get that little bit of data that you need. I think this is a good start. Thank and you. Don't tell anybody it's your initial one. Tell them you've been doing it for years.
The first and the best, right?
Can you tell me what it means when it says 8,384 customers with accounts? I'm not clear from this report, what that value, what value it brings to the report and what it actually means, because the participants are what matter on the one up above. So what does, what's the value of customers with accounts? I actually read this. Very nice.
Dan Arp, Recreation Superintendent. So what that number is with our ActiveNet, is those who have created accounts through ActiveNet, so we're sending like emails, that's who we're reaching. So when we do like publications and marketing, that's the number of residents that we can reach out to through our ActiveNet accounts because they've created accounts with us.
I would name this because I don't think you're clearly communicating that in this report. It looked to me like, what do you mean, people pay their fees through that?
Understood. And obviously, if
social media contacts or something, I don't know. We can come up with a better
term. Yes, exactly.
Come on. You guys are good at it. You younger ones, help me out there. But I just think that one could use a little
online users?
Something.
Okay. Yes, it is individuals who have created an account through ActiveNet. So if they sign up, you know, for the youth program or create by membership at the pool or whatever, they create an account through ActiveNet. But
I apologize. I didn't raise my hand. I'll get used to it. I apologize. I think that you should probably give them an overview of what ActiveNet is and what we what you use the software for.
So just real briefly, ActiveNet is a very comprehensive program, so keep this really short. But it's basically our registration software that we use as a Parks and Rec department. And it does a lot. I mean, basically, it's what helps us run everything. But we do our registration through that, so it's how we collect payments for any of our programs and through memberships that we sell, does reservations for these rooms and facilities. It's kind of, you know, it's the software that we use to kind of run our department. And then it has all the reports and tracking and data that we can collect from that. And so one of the things in there, and that's what this number represents, is every time any user needs to do any transaction with the department, they create an account. I shouldn't say any transaction because drop-in users don't create an account. But if they buy a membership, if they register for a program, if they make a reservation for a park or a room, they have to create an account, and therefore we then have their email address so that we can then communicate with them. And it helps us in promotions as we send out newsletters to those individuals with accounts.
I'm just being honest, I don't find the value because you sold 1,115 memberships through ActiveNet. You had 26,609. Anyway, I'm just not finding you're asking for true feedback, so I didn't grab me for anything.
No, absolutely, and that's the whole idea.
I'd rather use that space to grab me for something else.
Your ad here?
The 300,000 aquatic facility walk-ins. So if I divided that out, you have almost like 800 swimmers a day. I'm not an.
So that
are you? What does that really mean?
That number, we have a tracker at the front door that when you walk, you know, when you open the door and you walk through, it tracks that there's a person that walked through that door. And so what that number represents is half. I mean, that number is.
Oh, they also walked out.
They also walked out. So we reduced that number by half. So it was 600,000. So we're counting as individuals, but it doesn't mean that they went swimming, right? So it is, you know, anyone who walks through the door as well. But, I mean, we don't have a way to separate
right. Well,
that
no
number.
Parents watching swim meets might come in and out. And,
exactly. Which I think that number is important because there's still individuals who walk into the facility.
No, I get it. I just need
staff.
To make sure I understand the number. I don't want anyone to think that meant there was 300,000 swimmers in the year. No, thank you for the clarification. That's all.
Quick question on ActiveNet. Just clarification. If I buy a punch card at the Mac, do I have an account then?
You sure do.
Thank you.
Nothing, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Any public comments? CK? Okay. All right, let's move on to members' announcements and requests for information. Do we have any? I'll start. That was great. I saw the article in the paper. It was excellent. Went to the city fair or county fair or whatever last month. Big thank you to all the organizers and participants. It was great, and I heard wonderful things about the demolition derby. Mm-hmm. That was apparently the big hit. Then also, we had an incident at Sonoma Park last month with a suspicious package. Law enforcement, first responders, the park rangers, they were all there. They were wonderful. They were professional. I did hear one comment that they would like some lighting in the park for an emergency situation, maybe lighting that only they could turn on, and maybe that's something we could look at all our parks. Because to see the bomb tech go up to the box with a flashlight in one hand and his suit, it was a little unnerving. But everybody who responded to handle that situation, which, by the way, was just empty boxes duct taped up securely, they were wonderful, and we owe them big thanks for responding so quickly. And that's all I have to say. Anybody else? All right, so I guess we don't have a report from the school board liaison.
Not here.
No. Do we have a report from the Carson City Foundation for Parks and Recreation?
No, I think we already covered it with the...
And same for the...
We already covered the...
Okay, so then let's move on to future agenda items, discussion only. We're going to have the park facility and program of the month. And anything else?
Do you have any requests for which program or park that you want to hear about?
Oh, I'd love to have a status or an update. How are we doing on the park at Schultz Ranch?
Yeah, that's a brand new one. That would be
I
a good
I can tell
one.
You right now. Do you want to, well, for the next month?
Next
okay.
Month, yeah, next month. But I have an agenda item.
Okay. Independent of the discussion we had about the tennis courts and pickle.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
So I want to say that I agree with Kurt. I would like to see that potentially we bring Resolution 2009-R6 back to this board to truly look at and make any recommendations, because I would say this one needs a little help. So I want to just say I agreed with what Kurt was after earlier, that we need to actually bring this up to snuff. So I think it should come through this board first as a, hey, what do we want to see changed in this? So I'd like to see that as an agenda item.
Kurt Meyer, I completely agree with you. So that's kind of what I was getting at, that there's a lot of hard work that went into that and a lot of good work that went into that. It's a great document, and I think we should move forward with maybe, yeah, tweak it here or there, but we need to take a look at it. Thank you for suggesting that.
Anybody else? Commissioner Cartwright?
So with that resolution, could we have a discussion on the fee categories and fees charged generally and perhaps make some changes at that time? To do the military, the veterans, the people with disabilities.
Absolutely. Okay.
I mean, when you say fees, that's a big thing.
Well, we could make mention in those.
I mean,
but it certainly can be like an agenda discussion.
Yeah, a drop-in type fees for our facilities and membership fees. I mean, because it goes to park reservations and, mm-hmm. you know, it's huge. Yeah. So. Anyway, maybe I would rather not sit through that meeting and sit through a piece of that pie instead of just that entire meeting. So, but you're at your direction.
I think we could combine sort of that concept. I don't love that our fees are in a resolution, because anytime we need some flexibility to add fees or modify something, it makes it more complicated, and it's really hard for the public to find a resolution that was approved, especially 10 years ago. There were two efforts. The former parks director had two separate resolutions and two efforts that, because of the recession, was one of them didn't go through, and then another one, I'm not exactly sure what happened and why it didn't go through, if it just wasn't the right timing or, you know, the board didn't want to revise or update the resolution. But there was two separate efforts. So I have all that information. What I'd like to do is have a policy guiding document that would direct our fees, and then the fees would be something that we would review on an annual basis and, you know, come to this board, and then if we have to go to the Board of Supervisors for any direction. But I would love to have a little more flexibility than what the resolution provides us, so the staff are empowered to be able to make, you know, good, thoughtful decisions.
Okay. Commissioner Whitfield?
Just a quick comment on that. I appreciate your comment that it was a good document, but I tried reading it this afternoon. I'm not a lawyer. I'm an engineer. I found it to be impenetrable. I don't know how. I tried to compare the fee structure that was proposed for the range task force with that document, and I got completely lost. Now, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but that was pretty tough for me.
Okay.
I want to make sure, did I understand correctly that we did get the tennis and / pickleball item on the next agenda?
Jennifer? Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
The next one, it said future. We didn't say which one.
Which one? Oh.
Sorry.
And then just a reminder, in December we'll have a joint meeting. So if you have any topics for the joint meeting, I have heard that Open Space and some of the park commissioners have also requested this sort of offline and update on the Kings Canyon Federal Lands Access Program grant and the project that we're doing up there. It definitely impacts both, you know, parks, recreation, and open space. So we'll most likely have that item at minimum at the December meeting and anything else that you guys want to see come forward.
Okay.
Will that be a presentation only? I mean, or is it to a point in planning that that the neighbors should know about that meeting and have any input? I mean, will it be 20% plan, 50%, 75%? How would that look?
I'm not. It'll probably be a 50% or greater plan, but it'd be a great opportunity to work with the public. We could notice the neighbors, let them know, and be able to give them an opportunity to provide feedback. I'm not exactly sure where we'll be because we do have a federal partner. So they are the federal, you know, our federal partners, the FLAP team is designing it and everything like that. So it is a bit of a fluid process, but we'll make sure if we have a design stage where we can present, review, and seek public comment, I think that's the intent. But I don't know exactly where we'll be at that point.
Well, not only with the neighbors, I mean, I live in that neighborhood, and I also ride my mountain bike and walk the dogs up there on a very regular basis. And not only the neighbors be alerted to that, but maybe some kind of signage at that trailhead that there's going to be a meeting about that would go for really well, because there's a lot of people that use that for sure. And I think that they might have some wonderful ideas on those improvements before we get to a point where we can't make those ideas of reality. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Public comment. Any comments from the member of the public? All right. All right. In that case, I would entertain a motion on adjournment. All right. A second? All right. Oh, we're going to do it. All in favor? We're adjourned. Well, that was a big sign. You weren't even up here.
So entertaining. I can't.